Do you love this game? I mean, love it with your whole heart. Because if you don't, let's not even bother. Let's not open the door. They're just going to slam it right in our face. I love this game. I live this game. And there's 1,000 other guys waiting in the wings who are obsessed with this game. Obsession is going to beat talent every time. You got all the talent in the world, but are you obsessed? Is it all you ever think about? Let's face it, it's you against you out there. When you walk on that court, you have to think, I am the best guy out there. I don't care if LeBron's playing. So let me ask you again, do you love this game?
Yes.
Is there a newborn kitten purring in here right now? I couldn't hear you. Do you want to be in the NBA?
Yes.
Then let's make that happen. Never back down. Hello and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. I'm your host, Devin Decker, and joining me, my co-curator in this journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Mr. Sejan Serwick. Sejan?
Thank you, Devin. And tonight we are going to be partaking in an experiment with Sandler, a dance, as it were. That's what they call this game, isn't it? The dancer's chest or something to that effect?
I'm not sure what metaphor you're referring to. I do know that we're going to hustle tonight, though. That we had to hustle to put this entire episode together. Because unlike every other episode that we've done on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast up to this point, This film has only been out, like, worldwide for everybody to consume for a day and a half.
And it is the sweetest game indeed, Devin.
Ah, the sweetest game. Yes. I gotta drop it now. I was gonna try to move into it, but you threw me off with the sweetest game. We're covering Hustle. We're covering the 2022 Adam Sandler film starring Adam Sandler, Queen Latifah, Juancho, I cannot pronounce his last name. I'm proud I got Juancho out. And
Juancho Hernan Gomez, I believe. Oh, as somebody that's in the area and hears it a lot, I'm pretty sure that's the way at least everybody out here says it. Whether or not that is the correct way is up for debate. But
58 people who are playing himself and 2 people who are playing herself. It is the latest Netflix film that Adam Sandler has been a part of, and this is the first time since we started the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe that we've had a new Adam Sandler movie release. And we were a little bit like, what do we do? This is unprecedented. This is unexplored territory. How are we going to handle it?
The second a new movie came out, we completely lost our cool, and we were just like, "Well, shit, put it out the door, right? We can't ignore it. It'd be weird if we ignored it,
right? Like, it'd be weird if we're like, what? There's a new movie? What are you talking about? Are you from a parallel universe? Is this sort of madness from the multiverse that you're?"
The biggest thing would be that it would cut into our cred, right? Doing the show and then not focusing on the recent release. Now, like, it's also. It's not like the only release Adam Sandler has had of something while we have been recording this movie, too. Right? Recording this show, right? Correct me if I'm wrong on that.
I believe it is. If there's something you have in the wings that I'm unaware of.
Home Team. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, Home Team is a Happy Madison film.
It's a Happy Madison film produced by
Adam
Sandler.
And if
Adam
Sandler
but
were in it, we probably would have addressed it, at least in some small way. But
we could have addressed it, but we chose not on that one because he was not front and center in that movie. But this one could not be ignored, right?
Well, it's not even that he wasn't front and center in it. He doesn't appear in it at all. He doesn't have a small cameo. Honestly, Home Team feels like the consolation prize for the cadre of actors that Adam usually brings along on a production.
You want to be in the sports movie I'm making? Oh, yeah, that sounds awesome. Oh, it's not the one I'm in. I'm just producing. It's a second one. It's like he tricked everybody to show up on set for that one. They all thought they were showing up for the Hustle.
No, just Hustle. That is the most important thing about this film. The Hustle is a very different movie starring Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson.
And Hustle and Flow is a weird movie that features Terrence Howard and has the first R&B Oscar-nominated song, right?
I think it won, didn't it?
Did it?
I know. I don't know. Everybody, nobody would shut up about the song, so I would only
be surprised when I say that. It's I refuse to believe that the Oscars ever allowed that to happen on their part. So
that's an unfortunately good point. And if it were to happen, it'd probably be because Bonnie and Clyde made it happen. No, Moonlight definitely earned that Oscar. I love Moonlight. Also, not to be confused with Hustlers, the J-Lo movie, Jennifer Lopez, where she's a dancer at a strip club. And then they start robbing people.
The Jessica Alba movie, in which she's a dancer as well. What are we doing?
Well, and then I just wanted to get to, and it's also not the 1975 Hustle that I only saw the title of. I didn't see anything deeper. Yeah. No. So it is Hustle. Make sure when you're telling your friends to go see the new Adam Sandler movie on Netflix, you tell them it's Hustle. Because my father was very disappointed when he put on the Anne Hathaway movie yesterday. And I wasn't about to stop him.
I'm not going to lie, though. It's not going to be the last time I call it the Hustle tonight.
That's okay. But I just wanted to make sure we get a little bit out of it, right? So that people do know the title of this movie is Hustle.
Well, in a lot of ways, the surprisingly generic nature of the title is going to be probably an ongoing theme in a lot of the stuff I'm going to talk about with this movie tonight.
That's a pretty good point that I think you're making right off the bean. But before we get any deeper into our first impressions, let's tell people what we're doing here. This is also unique because this is the first time we're releasing a doubleheader. We also released an episode on Uncut Gems today. And I got to tell you, I'm patting myself on the back so hard for the fact that we decided to couple Uncut Gems and The Hustle.
And I'm going to say something, and you can disagree with me if you want, Dev, but I think this is going to be a thing to say. Go listen to that episode first.
Oh, no, definitely. If you're here, if somehow you are at the Hustle episode, which is episode 20...
Not the Hustle, but the Hustle.
The Hustle episode. You're throwing me off, Siege.
That's what I do.
That is what he lives for. Day. Yeah, pretty much. Oh my God, I'm the straight man in this group? You're Costello and I'm Abbott? No one would ever believe that if they knew what we really looked like. Anywho, bringing it back, Ollie. If you're listening to the Hustle episode, episode 20... and you haven't listened to episode 19, Uncut Gems, go back and listen to Uncut Gems.
Not least of which, because chronologically we did record it first, so there's going to be probably things that we say and do that will be informed by the character development of us in that episode.
I mean, that's a good point. Also, the Uncut Gems episode is specifically the capper to our theme of season 3, which was villains. Though, if I had a gun to my head, I think I could make an argument for this also being a villainous Adam Sandler movie. But we will get to that a little bit later on in the movie. It's especially important that you listen to Uncut Gems because I can't speak for Siege and I've not yet seen his notes. I am specifically going to be referring back a lot to Uncut Gems. And that is because this movie kind of in a lot of ways feels like
stop,
it is.
Stop stealing my old news, borrows and blues.
Oh, okay.
Stop it.
Right. So that is it. So this is a bonus episode. This is a bonus episode. It's tapped on to season 3 where we're covering the new Adam Sandler film Hustle. And what we do here on the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, when Hubie Halloween came out, and this is why it's unique, right? Every time you do a podcast, you have to treat it like it's somebody's first episode of the podcast. And even while we're insisting that you go back and listen to 19,
For the record, as a person that subsists on basically just podcasts and cheap coffee, I don't know any other podcast that does that, but I appreciate that we do.
Is the difference, the Siege and Devin difference, it's the Say Report difference, really. It's trying to make sure that whether it's your first episode or your 50th episode, you understand what's going on. And it's more suited to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe because you can kind of jump in anywhere with us, but if you're following along, it will be better.
Well, also, we have much more of a mission statement here. Yeah. Like, plain and simple. There is a focus here that we are trying to commit to, and that is the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe.
Right. And that whole conversation really got reignited in popular culture with the release of Hubie Halloween in October of 2020 when Steve Buscemi showed up and everybody's like, how did he get Steve Buscemi? But also more importantly, Ben Stiller showed up playing the same exact character that he portrayed in Happy Gilmore. And then suddenly everybody was like, oh my God, there's a shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. And Siegen and I, we looked at it, we noticed, and we're like, well, yeah, like I thought people understood that. And as we were having conversations with people about that, we came to find out that it was actually a pretty unexplored bit of popular culture, the fact that all these films exist together. And honestly, I think that highlights more the nature of the Adam Sandler film. It's a conversation I actually had with my mother that I'd like to share here, because I got together with the family to watch Hustle. They were very excited to watch it new, and especially knowing that I needed to watch it for this show. They're like, oh, we'll all get together on Wednesday. We'll get food and we'll watch the movie. It'll be a good time. And then while I was talking to my mother about those plans, and her response was, you know, I think the first time I really noticed Adam Sandler, like thought this guy could be a good guy, was The Waterboy. And my response was, oh, was it The Waterboy? Or do you think it was maybe The Wedding Singer? Because we definitely saw The Wedding Singer together. What that conversation with my mother proved was, she's like, well, yeah, I guess I had seen The Wedding Singer. And then because of what he did in The Wedding Singer, it's why I was willing to see The Waterboy. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting thing that I'm noticing. I mean, this episode, as much as it's going to be about The Hustle, and I promise it's going to be about The Hustle once we get through establishing the MO and why we're here today, and who we are, right? Devin Decker, Siegen Sarawyk from The Sarah Report, the show about everything, focusing in on just the Adam Sandler films that exist and will exist, right? The once and future Adam Sandler filmography.
The aim is focused. The ranting is not. Go ahead,
Dan. it's an interesting thing that I've noticed, that the film that most people credit to liking Adam Sandler is that one that follows the film that they first saw him in. Is that something that you've noticed in any of your conversations with people outside of the show, Siegen?
I mean, I've not noticed it, but it doesn't surprise me, because, like, you know, one-off enjoying a movie is one thing, but the second you see somebody in another thing and you go, why do I know that person from? And then you remember the other good thing. Like, that is how you establish a pattern, right?
Yeah,
you can't
exactly.
Just with one point. So, like, yes. But yeah, it's like giving a restaurant more than one go before you declare it to all your friends that you really think it's a good restaurant, right? You always want to make sure you've been a couple of times before you just say that, or you always have to put a caveat on it. Right. Let's go to this restaurant. We went that one time. It was pretty decent, right? And it's that same idea. With Adam Sandler, you got to be like, yeah, what the hell? Let's go see another one because we enjoyed that last one so much. And then, depending on what that second movie does for you, you either find yourself in one of two camps, like totally on board to go and watch the rest of his movies and do an entire podcast about it, or you find yourself in that weird position where you're just like, I don't think I'm going to do Adam Sandler movies anymore, leading to 10 years down the line, him doing something where you go, maybe this one, and then the cycle starts all anew.
Right, and it really is a cycle of rebirth and death that is almost tantamount to resurrection in a lot of ways. Okay. In some of the more Eastern philosophies,
some might forgive the fact that we have spent a year and a half watching every Adam Sandler movie and have not hated them all, as possibly maybe getting a little overzealous about this one person and possibly maybe perhaps writing the Bibles that would become the basis for the Church of Adam Sandler. At no point has it ever been more obvious than what you just said.
Well, I mean, I think it's just the nature of his career for everybody. And specifically for me, I mean, if you've listened to everything that we've put onto digital tape so far, there was a time where I hadn't really turned my back on Adam, but it certainly wasn't something that, like, I had to be there for every movie. Now, since Pixels, yeah, that's pretty much been the case.
Okay. Let's put a little bit more of a secular metaphor on it, and it's more like when a groundhog sticks its head out every once in a while to see if it sees its shadow or not, right? And sometimes you see your shadow and you get scared and you don't look again for a while, but sometimes you don't. Sometimes you come out from that hole that you're in and you experience the world beautiful and anew.
Wow, look at this. I like that. That is very much less secular. Anywho, so Hubie Halloween comes along and everybody seems surprised by the shared cinematic universe. And for me, who, you know, Little Nicky, the reviews, and I have this review basically tattooed in my mind, which is if you like Adam Sandler, you'll like this movie because it's just the greatest hits of everything that's come before.
Yeah.
And that, for me, that greatest hits, that reel that is Little Nicky, really established, oh, wow, all of these movies exist in the same universe. That's kind of cool. But if you're not somebody who saw Little Nicky, and trust me, you're not alone. The Little Nicky fans are a minority within the minority of people who enjoy Adam Sandler. Which, I don't know, that seems sort of weird to say. I've been thinking about it a lot lately, though, where my mother goes from The Waterboy to 50 First Dates. And I'm like, oh, you skipped like 6 years there.
Yeah, but so did the rest of the world. Yeah, no, I mean, like, here's the thing. The guy has just been working his ass off for so long, and he has a prolific career. You can't deny that, right? And then you start playing the numbers at that point. Learned we nothing from Uncut Gems. Right? Like, but at some point, like, the odds do not go in your favor, and he's got some stinkers, which we have definitely addressed some of them. I won't even say that there's none left, but we have definitely addressed some that have not been favorable for us, and we've addressed some that we've loved, and we've addressed a bunch in between. There's been a wide gambit of acceptance of Adam Sandler on this Adam Sandler podcast.
Yeah, in fact, if anything, I think that this one right here, Hustle, is going to firmly establish that just because we like or dislike an Adam Sandler film, that doesn't have any bearing on whether or not we will acknowledge its place among the stars of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. Because that's the last thing. That's the last most important thing about the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast is the fact that we are putting this cinematic universe together.
I mean, I like the universe where Adam Sandler and all of his friends are zombies, but yeah, we can get to that someday.
Yeah. I like that one too, because they destroy that Adam Sandler who devours planets while making fart jokes.
Yeah. And they
absorb his power.
And then Adam Sandler eats Andy Samberg. It's great.
It's wonderful. That's my dinner. Anyway, yes. I don't even know what we're talking about anymore. I think that's it. But most importantly is that our universe and what we put into it is subjective. We're not going to sit here and say, like, we are the authorities on this subject. What I would really like from the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe is that it inspires conversation. That you can talk about these movies and see how they fit together and whether that means they all exist in the same world or if it's just like sort of auteur theory, but on the actor's side by someone like Mr. Sandler. Mr. Sandler, that felt weird saying that.
Mr. Sandler.
Hello, Mr. Sandler.
I also wouldn't call him Adam either, though. So, like, we got to figure out a way to address him that is not either of those things a year and a half in.
You got it, A.S. No, A.S. does not work.
Putting my foot down on that one.
Good, I appreciate it. But yeah, so that's it. So that's what we're here to do. And this is a bonus episode where we're like, I guess we just do it. Let's just do the hustle. Let's see if the time that we've put in so far, 3 seasons, 18 months, will actually work if we apply it to a new piece of Adam's work. Or have we just been wasting our time and we should probably go back to formula?
I mean, the times, they are a-changing. let's be entirely honest here, folks. He has a limited, as much as he has had a prolific career, it is a limited career. He's not been making movies for eternity, right? So at some point, we're going to slowly get to the point where we have to address something new.
Right. But I'd like it if we do it in semi-real time. We'll see what happens. We'll see what works.
Yeah, really, I'm not going to tie ourselves to that cart. I'm not...
I know. I want to watch Murder Mystery 2 when it's new.
Yes, that is definitely a good example of one we probably will do in real time. But, you know, there's possibilities out there where maybe Hubie Halloween 2 doesn't get hit right away.
Right, especially if it drops in September. But yeah, so that's what we're here to do. And now let's talk a little bit about our first impressions of The Hustle, which are really cool in the fact that they're kind of the first impressions of the first impressions. I mean, I know that there've been articles written, but how many podcasts do you think have been done on this movie so far?
Are you kidding me? The number of other Adam Sandler podcasts alone. I'm sure this movie has already been talked about to death if you really went looking for it.
I mean, that's good. I mean, it did release in LA last weekend.
Yes.
Because all my LA friends were talking about it and like, have you seen it yet? Have you seen the film? And I'm like, no, I have to wait till Wednesday.
Thus, any podcasters with any backing then have definitely already
seen it. You'd certainly hope would have covered it, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I think the Wilder thing is that often when we're talking about first impressions, we're always comparing it to our first impression, like we're trying to dig out what our memory is of our first impressions, which is in and of itself probably the most biased thing ever, right? Like we have over the years recolored our picture of the past 1,000 times, like all of us have. So like, you know, we've talked about our first impressions of every movie up to this point with the caveat that like, you know, this is 30-year-old does, like looking back on 15-year-old does, what can I remember about that moment? This is literally, I finished this movie 20 minutes before we started making it. Now, let's not lie, there's been a couple of these movies that I have definitely watched for the first time for the show, and that's been a whole other conversation, but I still had an impression of what I thought the movie was before I then saw it. This movie didn't even give me the opportunity for that, right? Because it's so fresh.
Exactly, and that's interesting. It's an interesting way to do it. I mean, most of the films that we've covered, I'd actually say like half of them were my first time watching, but that didn't mean I existed in some sort of vacuum where nobody ever talked about Spanglish in front
exactly.
of me.
Exactly. Yeah. So like twist the conversation a little bit. It's more about how we had formed our impressions in a world in which the rest of the had kind of joined in. But other than you, Dev, I have not talked to anybody about this movie yet. Like, I haven't heard anybody talk about this movie. I have purposely, like, didn't look up any podcasts that might have talked about it over the last week, that sort of thing. Like, I just, by nature, this movie coming out yesterday, got to see it over the last 24 hours, and here we are talking about it. So this might be the cleanest impression of one of these films we ever get from us.
I love it. I absolutely love it. So with that said, what is your first impression of this film, Siege?
I have to be very careful here because I only did just see this movie, right? And there's always that chance that it's going to resettle somewhere else on the scale later on. So I need to be very clear about this when I say that this movie hit me in so many right ways as just a good movie. Like separate from doing this project, separate from us watching it for Adam Sandler, this movie was kind of special for me today because of the idea that it did something that all good movies really should do, and it affected me and kind of made my day better just by seeing it. I am not gonna like give the ins and outs of my entire business day, but like fact of the matter is like work is work and that's never fun, right? And so like feeling kind of down in the dumps from that sort of stuff and dealing with the day-to-day and some other things in the world, right? Getting to sit down and spend 2 hours watching this movie and feeling as good as I did afterwards is something that any good movie should do. And plenty of good movies have done for me, right? And so like it is so firmly sitting right now atop like this really high pedestal that, as I said, I need to be aware of that I am putting this movie up on a pedestal, having just seen it in the context in which I've seen it. Like I am aware of all of that. But as of right now, I have to say that it is gonna be really difficult to pull this movie apart today for me because of the fact that like I don't want to attribute the like the tropes and the nonsense and the weirdness that we've encountered with all of his movies, including the ones that we still held in high regard, right? I don't want to do that at all to this movie. We're going to. I'm not going to stop myself. That's why we're here. And more importantly, you shouldn't do that in general, right? Like, that's when you start getting those kinds of people that, like, start threatening other people online because they make fun of the Batman or some shit. Like you don't ever want to become that. You need to be able to acknowledge, like, the cracks and the faults and the things that you love because other people are going to, like, see those and address those. And you need to be willing to admit they're there or at least work with people who see those, right, before you fucking get, you know, you lose your mind in the real world. So I am applying all of that I can to this, and still this movie just rises to the fucking top. I mean, I'll be honest, of all of the movies that we've seen for this show, this is probably the best one that we've watched yet, like in terms of quality and in terms of rewatchability, because I feel like Uncut Gems is a really good quality movie. I don't know if I'll ever be able to like watch that on the reg, right? I'll definitely watch it again someday, but I don't think I'll be able to like sit down once a year and enjoy my time with Uncut Gems, whereas like this could easily become like a Thanksgiving movie for me, right? Or like a like when I'm home on Christmas and I need something to fill the time, I could put this movie on this year.
It's probably right? A good NBA championship week movie, which awesome. Is I think the coolest thing that yeah. It dropped on the same night as Game 3 of the championship series, where right. I don't know about you, I can't speak for you, but I feel like I have chit in the game because the Celtics are there.
Right. And there's also something to the idea that, like, I'm in basketball country in some ways out here. It's not like Indiana or anything like that, but like Utah and the Utah Jazz, they love them. They're tall corn boys that go off to play the b-ball. Like, that's the huge thing out here. And so, like, it's hard to get away from it, even if I didn't want to. And I don't. I love this stuff. But, like, so being in all of that, but also opposite end of the spectrum of that. When there is no basketball to be played, this is the kind of movie I would love to put on and just, like, be in some basketball.
Yeah. All right. I guess in terms of first impressions, I loved it the first time I seen it. I saw it last night when I watched it, really enjoyed it. A moment at the end, which we will talk about a little bit closer to the end so that you'll understand that there are spoilers. I don't think we've really talked any spoilers right now,
but not yet.
I promise you that spoilers are coming. And
basketball? What?
And before we get to those spoilers, we will give you a warning. And honestly, if you have Netflix, if you have access to Netflix, and right now, why wouldn't you? Season 4 of Stranger Things, even if you're just those people who get their subscription renewed when it's time for a show you like, this is a movie you should definitely check out.
This is Insane Report. We're not going to get into the whole, like, why you should have Netflix despite what everybody else is saying conversation.
Right.
But this is a very good example.
Yeah. If you happen to have Netflix and you're listening to this episode, there's no reason to not stop it and go watch the film so that we don't spoil anything for you. Because sure, a lot of what we're going to talk about is a big part of the journey of this movie.
I think this movie is worth the price of admission for 1 month of Netflix. So even if you don't have Netflix, pay the $20 to get it and get it in 4K and then have it for the month and watch this movie as one of the first things you watch.
Yeah, he brings up a good point. Even though, and we'll get to it later, this is a Netflix film that's had a lot of theatrical releases, which is very surprising to me. Like, I wasn't surprised when friends in LA had seen it. And again, it was like one or two people I knew who had seen it and asked, have you seen it yet? Because they know I do this. I mean, like, no, it's not in theaters here yet, so I have to wait for the Netflix drop. But then to also look up this morning showtimes and tickets and to see that it's playing in Providence, like, that was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I asked Sejin, and it's also playing in a bunch of theaters around him in Utah, which now that I know that there's a big basketball presence in Utah,
well, it's not,
only not
that.
Surprising.
Right. It's not only that. You got to remember, the other big thing about being out here, small rant, I will try and keep this short because, again, not the State Report, but the other big thing about being out here is that we're in Sundance country. And so there are a lot of movie people out here. There are a lot of movie lovers out here. In addition to that, there's a lot of people in L.A. that own theaters and chains and stuff in L.A. that also own a theater out here because this is where they're going to come and do their Sundance stuff. So if they have the rights to an L.A., there's a good chance there's a couple of places around here that already then are part of that circle. And then if those few have it, everybody else wants to compete, so everybody jumps on board. So we benefit a lot from that movie-goer environment that Sundance brings. We get a lot of these premieres. Because you say that you're really surprised as a Netflix movie that has so many, like, movie, you know, presence and all this. That's always been the case. Netflix has always put movies out around me. And I have to remember sometimes that I'm in, like, a weird market for that sort of thing. Because, like, I there's been tons of these Netflix premieres that have been in theaters. And, like, they needed to be in theater for, like, what, 2 weeks or something to qualify for award season, and so they just put them out somewhere, and then we end up being that somewhere.
Yeah. I suppose my view of Netflix and their theatrical releases is really colored by The Irishman, mm-hmm. where it was such a fight to find a theater that was carrying it, and then once we found one, because I had a friend who wanted to go see it, I said, oh, it's playing at this theater, so it's going to be a bit of a hike. His response was, oh, I didn't actually realize it was a Netflix movie, so I'm just going to watch it at home. So, like, oh, okay. So for it to be available, like, I wouldn't have been surprised if it were available on, like, Friday, but the fact that there are already showtimes available right now was a bit of a surprise.
So first spoiler alert, I don't know, but, like, the other big reason it's big here is, you know, the main dude in this movie is on the Utah Jazz, right?
No, I did not know that.
Yes, the kid. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I got that when you told me a couple of minutes ago, but
yeah, yeah. In addition to everything, the main basketball player in this movie is a player on the Utah Jazz. It's so
right. Which is, again, I wouldn't have been surprised if it were playing in Boston, because I had to go to Boston for Netflix movies before. But to see it in Providence, I don't know. I've also recently, and this is a bit of a Say Report tangent, I'm sorry, been watching Wings, and to realize how much Providence comes up in a show like that. made me realize, oh no, Providence, people know Providence. It's not some backwater capital, Devin.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about more if you enjoy that. We're going to be talking about Wings on the Say Report this upcoming episode. But back to this. Yeah, so first impressions, I enjoyed it. And then the second time that I watched it to make sure I had all of my like head straight to be able to analyze the film for the show, I enjoyed it again. It's not one of those ones that like the second time it loses its luster. And that's the mark of a good story. If you can rewatch it and maybe even pick up new things, like that's what I love in a movie. So
yeah,
I enjoy that.
Rewatchability is an important measurement for us.
But then, hopefully not to crib from anything new, old, borrowed, blue. I started thinking of films that were similar to this that might be considered a movie twin. And my mind really went to The Way Back, that Ben Affleck film that released at like the early days of the pandemic and was one of the first like direct to theater. You can buy this movie. We don't know what's going to happen films. And so that was another basketball film set in like the Northeast area, right? Like close enough that there are recognizable landmarks for the family, where we all sat down to watch it because there's nothing else to do. And the response to that film was not very positive at all. So going into The Hustle in sort of a similar situation and seeing everybody really enjoy it and their time with it and like the happy conversations about it and just the way that it sort of elevated everybody's mood, that was great. Like, this is a real feel-good movie. And it's not just one of those schmaltzy feel-good movies where, like, oh, everything kind of worked out in the end type of thing.
Yeah.
It's also backed up by, like, just crackerjack performances by everyone who's involved in it.
Everybody. Like, even the wild amount of people, as you hinted to earlier in your review, like, this idea that, like, the large majority of this cast is not what you would classify as actors, shall we say. Right, the way in which he dives into some real world personalities in this movie, and they get like the some of the greatest performances that I've seen in a long time on screen by guys that are NBA players, are retired NBA players. Like the well is so deep in this movie of like cameos and like and oh, remember that guy? I mean, Jaleel White is in this movie. There's so much good stuff going on screen in this movie as far as the acting from people that you would never expect. And that's, you know, like, in a weird way, it really kind of makes you reexamine your expectations of what people are capable of, right? But, like, I also had to remind myself that, like, NBA players have been moving to film for decades. That's always been kind of part of it, especially once you got into the 90s and everybody became a superstar. Like, either you were a superstar or you weren't playing basketball, essentially. And you know, look at Michael Jordan. I mean, look at Scottie Pippen. Like, Dennis Rodman had some really good ones, right? Didn't he do one with Dane Cook?
Well, he did Double Take. Is that the name of that movie? Where
that's
the
one with Orlando Jones, right?
No, yeah. What is the one where, like, he's on the cover and he's got his crazy hair? And he, the Dennis Rodman on a movie cover. I can't think of the name of the movie, but it's he did do one. I don't know if he did one with Dane Cook. I can only think of four Dane Cook movies. And it's Employee of the Month, My Best Friend's Girl, Good Luck Chuck, and Dan in Real Life. So if they, oh, I guess he was in Waiting, right? But Dennis Rodman isn't in Waiting. Hi, welcome to the Dane Cook Cinematic Universe podcast.
God.
It's just this conversation. I did the Dane Cook hand. I was proud of myself. But yeah, it is. Everybody is in there given their all, and it is really enjoyable. And it's also like, I can't think of his last name, but Kevin something from the Celtics and all of his appearances on Cheers.
Oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
Like, it is, of all of the professional sports, we do see the most actors coming from the NBA. And I think it's kind of the nature of the NBA in terms of...
Like New York and LA being hotspots for both acting and basketball.
Right. Well, it's not just that. It's also the fact that the NBA, as a thing that was big for us, like, it was huge in the 90s. In our generation, the basketball became huge. And it's because of Michael Jordan and then the way that he opened up that sport to everybody to kind of get involved. And maybe basketball was like that before, but when I talked to my father about it, in fact, I'm going to share an anecdote from my parents, and the fact that the Celtics playing the 76ers delayed their honeymoon a day.
Oh, man.
This is the first story that happened after we finished watching Hustle, because, slight spoilers, the main team that we're following is the Philadelphia 76ers, and then the last game that we see is against the Boston Celtics, and we will explore that a little bit later on. And my mother told the story of their honeymoon got delayed because the island they were traveling to, it was Bermuda. You can look this up. It's 1981. Their entire service industry went on strike. So that canceled their honeymoon. So then forced with having to go like find somewhere else to celebrate their union, they decided to drive to Cape Hatteras, which is the closest point in the contiguous U.S. to Bermuda. And they were going to leave that night, the night after their wedding. But because the Celtics were playing the 76ers, my father asked that they leave one day later so we would know if the Celtics made it to the championship or not. I tell that story, and it's one of those situations where, like, but, like, wouldn't he be able to know if they left? And honestly, regional sports was a big thing prior to the cable boom of the late 80s and early 90s. So, like, probably not.
Yep.
And it's just that interesting thing. And then as basketball grows and becomes a bigger thing, I mean, the career of a basketball player, it's been shifted, right? We have a lot of Tom Brady's, or we at least had a lot of Tom Brady's in the league. Somebody like LeBron James, who's been playing for, it feels like, ever. That's not necessarily what basketball was like before. So they wanted to make sure that they were making their money and they were using their image while they had it, right? So that there might be some legacy for them to fall back on, be it going into sports broadcasting or going into movies. So it is inherently baked into the DNA of the modern NBA to try to be like a movie star.
Yeah, no, I mean, the NBA became a sport about celebrity, not just like sports star, right? Like, and you had those celebrities that popped up all throughout history in every sport, but NBA is the place where it became prolific, where it became more about who you were off the court than who you were on the court. Look, these are all things that people have actually kind of levied against it as like a criticism. Like, these are not new things to be saying. It's just, this is the first time I think I've ever heard anybody, and I, you know, me and you talking about it, it doesn't surprise me that we're kind of fucking this conversation up. But we're not fucking it up. But this idea that usually this is seen as kind of the problem with the sport, right? Is that it became more about like guys wanting to be famous for more than just being able to play. And it led to a lot of drama on teams. I mean, you mentioned Michael Jordan, and like, you watch any documentary about Michael Jordan and there's inevitably that guy that talks about what an ass he was to play with, because it was always all about him and him on the field. You know, you get those guys that will play lip service to like, he was always good at passing the ball and all that, but you watch any Michael Jordan shit and it was never about that. It was always about, get me the ball and I'll get it in, right? I mean, that's literally the end of Space Jam, is him saying like, get me the ball and I'll fix this, I'll win this. And you know, like, It could be something that he acknowledges about himself. Like, I don't know the guy in person, or it might not be. But like, he really did redefine what it was to be a sports star, right? Like, he made it so that you weren't only just good at the game, you were good at everything, even if you weren't, right?
Yeah, it's true. But like, even with everything that Michael Jordan has done, this film, Hustle, The last thing that I can say about it before we look at the facts and figures is, this feels like the Space Jam of the NBA. This is the Space Jam New Legacy of the NBA, because they're bringing out everybody that's available to like show up for a fun little cameo. And if you know the sport, like, my father was having a field day spotting people while we watched this movie.
Oh, every person he shakes hands with, every person he nods to, right? And people call out, like, it's the amount of people he got just to show up on set for this movie. And, you know, it's not just him, right? So yeah, let's talk a little bit about facts and figures of this movie. So this is a Happy Madison production. It only came out yesterday, so we don't really have any, like, box office stats on it, right?
We don't have any... we anyway with a Netflix production?
But well, and that's a whole other conversation, right? I don't know, because as you pointed out, this one seems to be available more in theaters, so maybe we will. But the idea being that this one's hitting hard. We can at least point to a lot of the stuff as far as the criticism goes, because as you said, it's been out for a week already in some of the more popular places as far as film criticism goes. So it is sitting at a pretty sweet 90% on Rotten Tomatoes, and the same for the audience rating, right? So we're hitting high marks all around for this. So it's not just us saying hey, we really enjoyed this movie, and then even on a rewatch really found that it was still enjoyable. It seems like that seems to be the story across the board for it. But what's more impressive is what's going on kind of behind the scenes on this movie. So as it is a Happy Madison production and Sandler is the star of it, you'd really kind of get the feel that it was kind of one of his movies. But I gotta say, the number of people behind the scenes that are not his people is a whole other new world for us. So the guy that's directing it, I want to make sure I get his name right. Hold on. So it's
RK, I know that because it's an RK film.
Jeremiah Cigar. I have no
Okay,
idea what you're talking about.
no, I guess he. Well, it's a RK Films production, and his name came up. This is one of those movies. Even in the second time where I was trying to pay attention to who directed and who wrote it, because I was pretty sure that this wasn't something that Adam had written or a script that was brought to him that they gave punch up to. This was one of those situations where this is a really good movie. I'm gonna help you get it made.
So this guy is has never done a movie before this, and honestly had not done much in terms of TV before this. He'd done a couple of episodes of some documentary series, and all in all, that's his background. He is a documentary filmmaker, and in fact, a short form documentary filmmaker. If you really go by his resume, I don't know what he considers himself to be, but if going off of everything that he's done before this is his first movie, right? And the way in which this movie is filmed is pretty. It feels like you're in the room with stuff. There's a lot of really there's rough movement and cuts and all that good stuff. But you'd be forgiven for thinking it was a Safdie Brothers film, right? But there's this real feel to it that you do feel like you're watching basketball games. You watch like you're actually you feel like you're actually at that street game, for instance, when he first finds him, when he first finds Bo and stuff. There is so much going on in the filmmaking that is so influenced by the sports documentary style, but clearly a movie. I don't want anybody to go into this thinking it's some faux
It's
documentary or
not hope.
mockumentary
It's not
style.
hoop dreams. That is,
Right,
it's not hoop dreams.
exactly. But it definitely has that kind of aura about it. And so it's funny that you mentioned that, right? Because Hoop Dreams, it feels like it is weirdly influential spiritually. Right? It never comes across as being this is the they're just remaking Hoop Dreams. But you definitely get that feeling, right? And part of it is that even though it's not a documentary style, the filmmaking is just raw in the room style filmmaking. It's so good. The biggest thing that I always look at when I look at this kind of filmmaking is there's no filters used that glam up anybody. It's not that filters aren't used. Filters are always used in all filmmaking, but nothing is put on the there's no Vaseline on the lens to make Adam Sandler look 10 years younger, right? He looks like he's a dude in his 50s. There's jokes later on in the movie about him and Queen Latifah ribbing each other about their bodies and stuff, and they're living it. It's not that disingenuous thing where Ryan Gosling gets on screen and somebody gives him crap for gaining a little weight, and you look at the motherfucker and you're just like, yeah, but he's still Ryan Gosling. Guy could put on 10 pounds and it would still be muscle. So that kind of shit, right? Things are real life ugly in this movie. And I don't mean to say that people are ugly, but you see something in this movie and it feels like it's a real place. It feels like it's a real thing. The one that the moments that I was really thinking of is all those moments where he is being brought back through all these back rooms to get into places and ways into games, and that is something that is often cited as happens with scouts for a number of reasons. Games are often played in weird places so that people are not on display. But on top of that, scouts are often kind of brought in through back ways so that players don't know that scouts are there, right? So there's this whole kind of weird realm. And they never address this in the movie. It's never talked about in the movie, but you get that idea as you're watching it because of the way that it is filmed.
Yeah, that opening sequence where he's walking in to see the big Serbian, which
Yeah.
is the title of the character, and he goes,
Yeah.
"Are you taking me to a basketball game or a cockfight?" And the handler, and he has an actual name. The big Serbian doesn't, but the handler does. And unfortunately, it's escaped my mind right now. Maybe it's like Doug. I think it starts with a D. Goes, "We do everything here." Yeah, and it's just like, oh, okay, I'm here for the basketball game. Please do not take me to the cockfight.
Yeah, you kind of get this like weird moment where you're like, oh my god, I gotta murder this dude. Yeah, but it's awesome. Like that, those moments are beautiful. Or you know, that is beautifully counterpointed by the end with going into the high school to do the basketball game, right? Like, yeah. And they're just in this dinky ass little high school gym, right?
Yeah, one of those. That whole moment, like, I would love to attend an event like that. Like, it's just players and general managers, but then you have, like, that one kid who's sitting there next to Goldstein, who's like, who is this guy? And he's like, I don't know. I'm like, I'm an 8-year-old. I'm just waiting to be picked up by my mom, and she has neglected me. And then suddenly, look at all these NBA stars who are at my high school. Yeah.
And then on the writing side, right? So I'm going to mention Will Fetters first. So Will Fetters is a writer producer that's been in Hollywood for a few years now, and has written some really like more than decently well received dramas, right? Like, so he's a writer on the Lady Gaga Brad A Star Is Born.
A Star Is Born.
what's his Bradley Whitford? What's not
Bradley Cooper?
Bradley Cooper. Thank you, Bradley Whitford. And Lady Gaga in A Star Is Born.
Jeremy Jeremanu.
So he's on as a writer on that. He does he does the Pattinson one from a few years ago, Remember Me, right? Which is, I think, the weird one about the car accident, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah.
So these are the kinds of movies he's making. And like I said, well received dramas that are highlighted and even Oscar nominees, right? So you have that kind of like cred as far as him as the writer. And then the dude he is teamed up with, I don't know what the distribution is in the work here, but Taylor McTernan. I think that's how you say his name, because the only reason I think I've heard his name before is because this dude was a friggin' writer for EA. He writes their sports games.
Oh, okay.
So he has written for like the NBA games, like NBA 2K19 and 20 at least. But like that is the other writer on this movie. So you have these two guys, one that is clearly the sports guy and one that is clearly the Hollywood guy, and then this is the movie that they write, right? Like and you know how movies are. Like, God knows, this was probably written by some poor sap 20 years ago and he's been trying to get it made, and these two are the last writers to touch it, so their name gets on it. But like, that is the pedigree that is behind the script on this movie.
And that's excellent. I figured the only time that I saw Adam's name in the beginning outside of Happy Madison was that he and Alan Covert were executive producers. And
which
I'm just
is
like,
what
this
when,
is awesome.
When, like, but that's what that means when Happy Madison produces a film, right?
Right.
Those two are going to be in somewhere in the producer credits, but like, it doesn't get much deeper than that for some of his usual fare. So it's actually really, really interesting one for us to look at.
Yeah, as a Happy Madison film, it is sort of weirdly this outlier in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. and I'm excited to explore it as we get deeper into the episode.
So the only other behind-the-scenes thing worth really mentioning is how much the NBA is clearly behind this movie.
Is it?
But to that point, they do that thing where you don't see them. You see their players. You see, you know what I mean? Like, and like, we are smart enough to pick up on that, and I'm sure 90% of the audiences are. But like, you'd be forgiven if you thought that this was just, you know, that this was Adam Sandler making a basketball love story, you know, a love story to the sport, and not like a marketing tool for the entire for the entire NBA, because that's what these movies are for them, right? So, why that becomes kind of important. In the long-term scheme of things, is there some things that happen in this movie that very often happen in Adam Sandler movies where you just have to wonder sometimes if he really understands how poor people live. But like, that's because with him behind this movie on one hand and the NBA behind this movie on the other, no, nobody knows how a poor person actually lives anywhere in this movie. Like, there's some really great stuff with Bo and his personal life that I think really hits it. But I mean specifically the ways in which what is Sandler's character's name? Stan Sugarman. There's some ways in which Stan Sugarman lives where we're supposed to believe that he is in a certain class of people, but then he pulls off some stuff throughout this movie where you're just like, damn, Stan, like, were you just sitting on that cash? What were you doing?
He also happens to have an Amex Black card with no limit Because just the amount of money that he pours out in this movie.
The one moment for me that really gets me is he gets him the Kobe shoes, right? It's the Kobe Bryants that he hands him. And like, and he's just like, and it's a phenomenal like moment, and it's a beautiful moment, and it makes total sense why that would be the shoe Stan would want to get him. But like, I don't believe for a second that that's the shoe that Stan could afford.
Well, it's not about affording. It's about cashing in favors. Because also, you need to understand, he has this daughter, Alex, who wants to go to film school, and all of the various film equipment that she has is not the type of stuff somebody who is supposed to represent a certain socioeconomic class would have access to. She's got, like, professional-grade cameras.
Yeah, I know, and going to film school, especially in the city. Yes.
Well, not well. She hasn't applied yet. She's not sure if she's going to apply.
No, but the idea that she even could, and it's not something that blows up Stan's life, but right, like that whole. There's some things that do happen in this, and that are just it's the magic of film in a lot of ways, and like you could attribute that to all of Sandler's movies where I've given him this exact criticism. I will say in this movie it's not as egregious, but it's definitely there. And I think, as I said, it kind of comes from this idea that all the people behind this movie, as much as they are trying to make this like heartfelt feature about a basketball player getting to the NBA, the most obvious point at which you realize it's just a commercial for the NBA is when you look at the ways in which money is just no object in this film.
Oh, and they also highlight that when they're like, so what's the minimum? What's the minimum salary for an NBA player? And Stan, without blinking, is like, $900,000.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm sorry, how much money? I wish I cared more about basketball than hockey as a kid.
Yeah, I know.
where in hockey, they're like, oh yeah, we don't get paid during the playoffs because it's just about the love of the game.
And I hope you have a good dentist that likes you, because we ain't paying for that dental work.
Yeah, oof, it is. That was the moment where I'm like, and everything we're talking about just like sort of being out of touch with what it means to be poor. When you think the minimum amount of money somebody should be making is $900,000.
I mean, it also goes back to the celebrity conversation, right? It's another reason why these guys live the lives and expect the things that they expect out of life, is because when they go a year making $1 million at a time, like, yeah, somebody offering them a movie role eventually is like bound to happen.
Yeah, because they have the recognition. They can put butts in seats, and that's really what matters. All right, so is it time for the synopsis, Siege? It feels like it's time for the synopsis.
Yeah, let's break this down. We've talked enough about how we kind of feel about the movie. Let's see what's going on with in the actual film.
All right. Stan Sugarman, a scout for the Philadelphia 76ers, sees his hard work pay off when owner Rex Merrick promotes him to assistant coach. But before the bubbles begin to settle on the champagne, Rex dies, and primary control of the team falls to his son, Vince. 3 months later, Vince calls Stan to his office and tells him that while he is valuable as a coach, he is indispensable as a scout and will be going back to Spain to see a new prospect to help the team win a championship, assuring Stan's role will be restored once he finds the missing piece to victory. Despite his wife's urgings to quit, Stan flies out to Mallorca. When the player he has come to watch isn't playing due to injury, Stan sets out to shoot some hoops. Arriving at a local street court, Stan finds it absolutely mobbed and sets eyes on the player of his dreams, Bo Cruz. Despite not having the support of Vince or the team, Stan convinces Bo to come to Philadelphia. Trouble starts as soon as they arrive. Bo is detained by customs for an aggravated assault charge from 5 years earlier. As a favor to Stan, a member of the Sixers legal team bails him out, but warns that if Bo gets into any trouble, his visa will be revoked. Stan takes Bo to an open run for him to show off his skills, but the predicted second pick for the NBA draft, Kermit Wiltz, is also there, hoping to become the number one pick, and he gets into Bo's head, affecting his gameplay. After the event and a remark from Vince, Stan finally quits his job to dedicate himself to coaching Bo's natural talent so he can function in professional basketball. With 6 weeks until the combine, he's got plenty of work ahead of him. While Bo rises to every challenge and looks ready, Stan finds out that Vince has been badmouthing the player to the entire league and no other team wants to deal with him, essentially freezing him out of the draft event. Stan's daughter suggests making Bo go viral online, and soon everybody is clamoring to see what Bo knows. Kermit is also at the draft draft combine and starts in with digs at his daughter, causing Bo to angrily shove him to the ground. Coupled with his aggravated assault charge, Bo leaves the scrimmage convinced this outburst means he's blown his chance at the NBA. Driving back to the airport, the two acknowledge how much they have done for each other over the past 6 weeks. Stan is about to leave when he gets a call to an invite-only event just for players and general managers, and the two set off to take advantage of this third chance. 5 months later, Bo has been drafted by the Celtics, and Stan reinstated as assistant coach by Rex's daughter, Kat, to help clean up the mess left behind by her brother.
Yeah, man. So I think one of the really interesting things in that synopsis, like, is if you really pay attention to it and if you see it, you know, on display in front of you, it feels like there was probably a movie before this movie. Right, like as I said before, we kind of never really know about the life of Scripps beforehand. It's really rare we get a glimpse into what happens to a movie from literally inception to creation. But it feels like there was probably this movie before that was much more Adam Sandler-y, right? And I don't necessarily mean that it was like goofy dick and fart joke style, like Will, you know, I was going to say Will Arnett, but Will Ferrell already made that movie, right? Like Semi-Pro, we all love, but that's not what this movie was. I think this movie was this heartfelt sports drama before. But what I think is that then it got into the hands of somebody a little bit more capable, shall we say, of creating a more viable film. And that is where you kind of get like your Hollywood writer in and your sports team, you know, video game writer. Like they come in and actually put together a much more interesting, complex script, because there are these little things throughout the story that are just so on the nose. And one of the biggest things for me is kind of the introduction of the idea of his assault charge and like the foreshadowing, oh, that's going to be the you know, Chekhov's assault charge, right? Like later on, it's going to come back and be like the important bit.
Chekhov
of the whole...
paid off his beach house with all the times they evoked his name in this script. And I'm not upset about it, but the more that they
do it, the more kind of belittling it becomes to all the other ones, right? Like every time something pops up and you're like, oh, that'll come back later. At some point you've guessed the rest of the movie, right? So there is some of that going on, but none more than that assault charge for me, where I was just so convinced that was going to become like the last like 30 minutes of this movie. And yeah, it plays into it. It is important that it comes back because it gets in Bo's head that is such an important thing. But in the real world of this movie, I should clarify, within the world outside of Bo in this movie, it actually isn't that huge of a deal, right? Especially in the NBA. Like,
Ron Artest joke that happens, that's the spoiler part. I'm sorry I didn't say it before reading the synopsis. In fact, I might jump in and add something, so if you already heard that, this is moot what I'm saying. But yeah, all spoilers are off the table right now when I tell you the end of the movie.
Yeah.
But even then, that synopsis doesn't spoil a lot of the intangibles of this film.
Yeah.
So you could still probably go see it after hearing that and have an enjoyable time. Sorry. But now, big old spoilers, that Ron Artest joke about Ron Artest beat up all of Detroit and they love him hits so true for me.
It was
I'm just like, and then also like that assault charge, and in my head I'm like, aren't there NFL players who have like straight murdered people who are beloved and still working?
What city is Pittsburgh in? What state is Pittsburgh in?
Also in Pennsylvania.
I mean, we're talking about a state, right, where they literally have to put up barbed wire around the opposing teams coming into the field for the friggin' Steelers, right? Like that is that, like, this is not a kind place when it comes to sports. So an aggravated assault charge from 5 years ago that he is actively, like, obviously trying to keep a cap on, like he would have been fine. But in his head, right? And that's what I mean by they make it much more subtle, much more understandable, much more grounded and real, in that it means more to him than it really seems to anybody else in this movie. And I applaud them for that. But dialing it back, that moment when that assault charge comes up and it is brought to light and it just feels like, oh my God, this is going to be the movie. Like that is the way the movie goes if it's just like Sandler and Colbert writing this, right? But they dial it back and they go in a different direction. And you get that feeling throughout this entire movie. There's a moment where this thing happens and you think, oh, it's going to get silly, and then it doesn't. It goes in a different direction. Or there's a moment where it allows itself to get silly, but not as silly as it maybe could have. Like the amount of times I felt in this movie, Sandler and whatever mentality, whatever crew, whatever thing was there with him had a really good for lack of a better term, leash on him for this movie. And that has been something that we have pointed out with some of his lesser well-received films, is that it, you can always tell that he just goes so far because him and his friends are having a good time and they're having fun doing it. But the subtlety that is on display in this movie is one of the reasons that it is held so high in esteem for me right now, is because it's not that Sandler is not present in this film, but the amount of times that he is held back from going what I would consider to be too far for my enjoyment is on display throughout this movie.
Yeah, he is. I mean, this is the same Adam Sandler that we saw in Uncut Gems, mm-hmm. in just so many ways. This dedication to this character, this making sure that it's not about the joke, it is about the story, yeah. which is, I mean, there exist two Adam Sandlers in all of us, one who prioritizes the joke and one who prioritizes the plot.
Which one do you feed?
And the fact is Adam's been able to feed both of them, and they've both weirdly thrived within him, but he's very good at understanding which one needs to come out at any given time, and the fact that he let that plot is important side of himself come out for this film is what really does make this film stand out.
I had so many different conversations in my head, like watching this movie based on conversations we have had before. Right. And I think the one of the ones that kept bubbling to the surface is kind of the conversation that we've had really recently about him, about kind of just like vengefully making shitty films and like being like, fine, fuck it. You people want to make this, like it almost feels like this is him like pointing that rage in a different direction, right? Vengefully going out there and showing that he can make a film. He can make a good drama too. He doesn't just have to depend on his Paul Thomas Andersons. He doesn't just have to depend on his Safdie brothers. Like he is capable of creating that environment for himself as well. He wants to prove that he can choose. He doesn't have to. And he's not wrong. The amount of times we have given him shit for a movie, those are usually the movies where he makes the most money.
Right.
Like for like little investment, great gains, right? And that's kind of it, is right. Is like, and maybe this is him maturing. I don't know. I don't want to really attribute it to that because I don't want to act like we know the guy. But like this idea that this may be just kind of an older Sandler who's settling in and being like, look, you all don't expect this from me, but look, I can do it. As opposed to a younger, angrier Sandler. Who's like, y'all don't think I can do it? Then fine, fuck you, I won't. It, right? Like, it's that evolution as artists that's really kind of cool to see. And you know, again, I'm just describing that story entirely myself to it. But considering the conversations that we have had about the ways in which he has addressed films before, you know, I think it's really funny because we talked about Uncut Gems. Again, go listen to that episode first. But we talked in that about the conversation he had with Howard Stern, where Stern said to him, you know, you're getting a lot of Oscar buzz. What are you going to do if you don't get the Oscar? And he said, then I'm going to go make the shittiest movie I possibly can, which is a great joke at the time, because considering everything he had done up to that point, you'd believe it. But what he appears to have done instead for not getting the Oscar was he turned around and proved he could do it again.
Right. With a Hubie Halloween in between. Like, let's not forget Hubie Halloween happened in between. And Hubie Halloween, I mean, there are people who straight up love that movie. Next season, it's for the fans. And honestly, even though we've already covered it, like, that's the most requested thing I hear from people is, do we be Halloween again?
Because if there's ever going to be a revisit, there's one in particular that we will revisit, and it's only going to be for the joke, and I'm not even going to let it go here because it's too good of a joke.
I love you, Siege. I do. But it is. But he did Hubie Halloween in between. So, yeah, but Uncut Gems, right? Because I was thinking exactly of that Howard Stern thing of, I will make the worst film ever. And there's a big theme in this film, not so much the never back down, which is very important, but the it's you against you out there. Mm-hmm. Your hardest opponent, the voice that you're going to have to quiet the strongest is that voice of doubt within you, is your own hang-ups, your own, because also playing against yourself is your best opponent, because that person knows all of the things that you are weak against, all of the ways to hurt you. Your mind and your doubts and your fear are these things that are inside you, and if they're allowed to bubble to the surface, they will defeat you every time if you're trying to do some grand endeavor.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine that something like Hustle comes out, and the reason why it feels like such a cool companion piece to Uncut Gems, why I'm so happy that both of these episodes have dropped today so that you can kind of experience them like in tandem as an almost double feature, is the fact that he didn't win that Oscar, and he made that joke to Howard Stern. And rather than listen to that voice that he said out loud on Howard Stern, "I'm going to make the worst movie ever if I don't win that Oscar," he says that, and he says, "Fuck it, I'm going to do it again. I'm going to do it, and I'm going to make sure that it's my production company behind it. I'm going to make sure that there's not the softies to give the credit to. The person that you can give credit to is me on this film. Because it's not me going and being a hired gun for a film. This is my production company, me starring in the film and saying, look, I am capable of doing this."
Yeah, and it's that second point of connection that we were talking about really early on, right? Like, you see him do it the one time and you think, well, that was cool. And then you see him do it again and suddenly that rebuilds that idea in your head. And, like, especially for us here, like, our two points of connection right next to each other, like, we have set this up in a luckily beautiful way.
Yeah, right? They could have gone very badly. I knew that. I'm like, hey, they're both about basketball. That's enough.
And it wasn't on us, right?
Right.
But it wasn't on us, right? It'd be entirely on Sandler. And we've talked in the past, like, that has always been the case, is it always really depends on where he puts his foot next and what camp he wants to land in and whether or not you're willing to visit it with him. Like, it really has always depended on what he wants to do, that it has any outside criticism. Like, I've never met a guy more bulletproof than Adam Sandler when it comes to – look at that.
Look at you.
You're welcome, Bulletproof. Proof. We'll never talk about you again.
We're gonna have to eventually. Okay, sorry, I'm sorry, Sage.
No, it's fine. There are worse movies than Bulletproof. But this idea being that, like he's Teflon, right? Like, it all just slides right off. The big thing about this movie and a lot of what you're kind of reinvoking me is another conversation I was having the whole time I was watching this, and you kind of already said it, but I'm gonna put it in dumber words, is like. I know he loves basketball, clearly, right? Between his character, Davey, Uncut Gem, like, he is a person that loves basketball outside of filming. But this is definitely about him in movies, right? Like, this entire movie felt like it was him kind of like kind of explaining, like, himself and explaining why he's been able to do this and proving time and time again throughout this movie and his career, right? Yeah, it was just another one of those conversations that I kept coming back to, was especially that speech that you heard Devin deliver so beautifully at the beginning of this episode. Like, you were place basketball in that kind of like subtext with film, and just imagine Adam Sandler just yelling at himself, and you basically get what kind of motivational speech he must give himself every time he walks onto the set of Grown Ups 3.
I mean, that speech pulled from my mind the conversation I would have with myself every time we come to do this show, right? Because I have to be obsessed with Adam Sandler, to the fact that people I have. Since we recorded the last episode, I got a new chair and I needed a cover for it. And Sijin, I think half jokingly, suggested this blanket of Adam Sandler faces.
One third jokingly.
I bought two of them. And I showed off the chair to people in photos and that, and everybody's like, oh God, your obsession with Adam Sandler. And then to watch Hustle and that speech about like, There are a bunch of people out there who are talking about Adam Sandler, and the way that I can be different about it is just for this brief time where I am in front of this microphone talking about these films, it needs to border on obsession with everything that we're seeing.
Why would we do this if we weren't able to muster that up, even if it's only just for the 2 hours that we record this every month? We have to, 4 hours this month. I'm spent. No, luckily what we did is we picked two good movies.
This was a big swing, but let's not talk about us. Let's talk Adam Sandler. Let's do it. But you're not wrong. I mean, you talk about all these conversations that it invoked in you. They're the same sort of things that I thought about in terms of, and I think like you talked about this movie making you feel good and like sort of invigorating you after a hard day of work. And it does. This movie, and it's feel good, and that you put the work in, you'll get the reward. Yeah. Like, if you're a creative person and like maybe you're on the fence about what you do and you see something like this, like it weirdly inspired me that like Because I was tired. We had done that. We just came off of Brendan Fraser History Month. And then I'm like, but no, you keep working at it. Like, it's
right. And you know, like, let's not beat around the bush. This is a sports drama, right? Like, and there's a lot of those tropes that come along with it. And more importantly, it's very much the white savior sports drama. As you mentioned earlier, it really invokes a lot of these like older movies for you. The big one for me that I kept thinking of was Hardball with Keanu Reeves, where he coaches a bunch of inner city black kids, right? And he's like the like drunk old white dude. The Way Back with Ben Affleck is a good example. Like, but this idea of like it's the same thing that gets levied against The Blind Side, right? In a lot of ways, like I they change it up because it's a woman as the white person this time, but it really is the same idea.
Tim McGraw is still there, and I don't know. I've never seen The Blind Side, but that's what I have to say.
You know, and a lot of these movies will kind of hide behind the trope of like, well, it's a true story, but yeah, you're picking very specific ones. This one, not much. Like, it is very much a very good look into this world, but it's not based on any in particular event or person as much as it invokes a lot of that realism with bringing in all the real people and things like that. But
huge Miami Heat circa 2010 vibes in this thing. And especially, like, I was working for Carnival Cruise Lines at the time, and that's Mickey Aronson who runs Carnival Cruise Line. Like, that was the big CEO at the time. And it was his son who got his hands on the Heat, who did the unthinkable and brought together three really good players for an NBA team. Like, why they got to be spread out? Why can't we just pay them all the money and have them play in us and guarantee championships?
That was when LeBron left Cleveland.
Left Cleveland,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that was huge.
With Chris Bosh, and I can't remember who the third guy was.
Everybody was burning their jerseys and their grills in their backyard.
Yeah, that's what it is. And it just feels that same way in terms of like this son trying to prove himself to the memory and the successes of his father.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, oh, I remember being there because of the conversations. First of all, I was stationed out of Florida. So if I was like on land and I would go to sports bars to just like feel normal for an hour, the people I were talking to were always talking about that Miami Heat thing and what it would mean for the sport. And then to know that, like, I also work for a company that, like, tangentially owns that team.
Yeah.
Like, it was... And so then to watch this movie and be like, man, Ben Foster's character is so Mickey Aronson Jr.
Well, again, it speaks to the idea that there was a guy behind the script that was very into the idea of the sport. So, like, it has a lot of really good pedigree in that vein, and you're not wrong to feel that way, right? Yeah. But, yeah, man, I mean, and famously, like, for that particular deal, right, is the Heat didn't go on to become, like, for a couple of years, they were, forgive the pun, on fire, right?
They were on fire that one year, and then the next year, the Celtics put them out.
Yeah,
and then the Heat beat them the year afterwards, and they sort of traded. But like, it wasn't one of those things where like dynasty making move.
Yeah, so it didn't pay off, right? Yeah. Like, they spent all this money on these huge players, and then in the end, it didn't really do much. There's a lot of love going on in that way for the, like, sports and the sports drama throughout this whole movie, right? These characters exist in the real world, and it's so great to see them on screen because they invoke these exact feelings that we're talking about. So this movie plays your heart like strings. I don't want to act like this movie is doing something magically different that reinvigorates or reinvents the genre. Like, all I'm saying about what this movie does is takes the genre and does it well.
Excellent. Now I'm going to pull the e-brake here. I love this conversation. I'm sorry to derail it, but we're going to just keep cannibalizing new, old, borrowed blue if we continue down
this
road.
So we just need to
jump into, this is new, old, borrowed blue. It's something you're going to get every episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, where we look at the movie and we talk about something new. If this movie were to become part of the cinematic universe, something old that we've seen before, something borrowed from the rest of Hollywood, and then something blue, the definition of which is hotly debated every time we get to it. And someday, Seijin will understand what we're looking for. I don't.
Once the cameras are off, Devin and I are at each other's throat about it all the time.
All the time. So let's kick it off. I would like to go first with my new.
Okay. Yeah.
It's Queen Latifah. I'm going to go with the easy one, but it is. Adam Sandler, as much as he is a voice of the 90s, as much as when you think about the 90s, if there was a 90s Mount Rushmore, Adam Sandler's face would definitely be on the ballot. The fact that he is continually grabbing these great actors from the 90s and putting him into films with him as he continues his march forward with his career. And putting someone like Queen Latifah in this movie, who she's having a bit of a moment with The Equalizer on CBS. Like it is that perfect example of Adam Sandler being able to take the pulse of culture at the time, right? And understand what people want to see and who people like are working and would probably be up for appearing in an Adam Sandler film. And Queen Latifah, as much as she is known as the singer that she was, right, when she was first Queen Latifah, and then you look at her career, she has been in some of the funniest movies, in my opinion, from the 2000s.
No fucking joke. And part of it is because it was just the right time, and I was finally dating without my parents having to kind of accompany me. Saw Bringing Down the House 3 times in theaters. And, like, I know. It is not a good movie. I'm not going to sit here and be like, everybody misunderstands that movie. No, everybody knows exactly what that movie is. But that movie is the definition of comfort food for me. You know what I mean? Like I could sit down and gobble the shit up out of that movie again this very moment. And, like, I that is the first thing I always think of. She has done much better films. She has done much better work in the world than that movie. But that there is something about Bringing Down the House that will always be in my heart.
So... I have to admit here, I have to just derail from Adam Sandler for the briefest of moments to say my whole speech about she has done some of the funniest movies, the movie in the forefront on the pedestal in my mind during that whole speech was Bringing Down the House. And it is not just the fact that Queen Latifah is hilarious in it. It is that she is hilarious against Steve Martin. One of the funniest people who has ever, like, told a joke.
I love Steve Martin. This is not going to be me, like, starting to shit on him and or anything like that.
For December, right?
And don't tell Steve because I'm still enjoying his work. But there is a point in his career where he got very kind of held back and very kind of introverted. And in some of the movies, it works really well. His own movie, Shop Girl, it's a really good part in his life that he made that movie. Like, it makes sense. Bringing Down the House. He ends up being kind of so kind of in focused and so kind of stuck up in what he's dealing with in the real world that it's not his best performance. Part of the reason why that movie catches a lot of slack, she ends up outshining him. And part of that is because he's kind of in his weird space where he's still figuring his shit out. And part of it is because she suddenly realizes she has to carry a fucking movie. And goddamn, does she carry that movie.
Right. And now, since we're talking about that, in this film with Sandler, they are such a team. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's just a really good written relationship. Yeah. Can we give it applause for that? Oh. Because especially on this show, we have not seen great relationships between him and women. We have seen some good ones, but not all of them. This was phenomenal. This like she is great as she's clearly his wife. Is it his daughter or his stepdaughter?
It's his daughter. They've been together since college. But then they waited to have a child.
Right.
Like, it's one of those situations where, you know, again, spoilers. Please go watch this movie if you haven't and you're this deep into the episode.
And to be clear, I realized I should clarify this. It wasn't because I was like, that kid's black. I can't be his. It's this idea that there's these kind of ways in which he plays with her and plays with other people in, like, he is very, very faithful and loyal to her in all ways. But there's definitely moments in this movie where people give him shit because he's traveling so much. And right. He's surrounded by a bunch of dudes. And, like, to Stan's credit, he never kind of truly gets pulled into those worlds, right? But there was just all of these moments where I was trying to figure out if he was recently married to her and, like, it was a late relationship.
No. There's that whole scene with Bo where they're having dinner at the house. And she tells of how they met, and it was the silent 3-hour ride home from a game at, like, Virginia. And then once they got back, he yelled loudly, I'm going to marry you and we're going to have athletic children. And look it, we did that. Well, not so much athletic. She's short of breath when she's folding laundry or whatever the joke is there.
asshole.
Yeah. It's very much they've been together for a long time. Yeah. But the daughter, like, I feel like they've been together for 30 years and he's missed 9 of her birthdays. These are like figures that are given there. Then she's just finishing up high school in this movie. So it feels like it was one of those situations where he and her were both trying to make their dreams happen before they decided to have a child.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and part of it is because somewhere along the line, Stan gets injured, right? We're never... Are we?
It happens in college.
Like,
it happens in senior year of college.
It's just it's not dwelled on, but it's beautifully it's a great example of show don't tell, right? Where we just see the injury more than we ever really talk about it. And it's
beautiful freaking makeup work on that.
Oh my god.
There's one moment like, where it is out of the
cast.
The cast. It's not really a cast, sling. What is it? The thing that like it,
yeah,
I'm not sure the name of it right now, and I'm sure we'll do it. It's like you put it on your leg, and it keeps it. I don't know what the heck is that thing called, Siege? And this is going to bother me.
I would call it a wrist guard. I don't know what we're talking about anymore.
It's not so much a wrist guard though. It's like when you break your finger and you put it into
a splint.
A splint. It's like a hand splint.
Yeah, yeah.
It's an impressive prop for starters. But then there's like a few times where he has the splint off. And the work that they did on his hand so that you can see just how damaged it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And that moment, you say it's blink and you miss it. It is such a small percentage of this film, him dwelling on what got him to this point in his life. But it also explains why Leon Rich, the sports agent, is so devoted to him.
Yeah.
Because he saved his life and in turn gave up his chance at playing basketball, at being involved in this game on the bench instead of behind it. That story of, I looked up, there was a telephone pole and I reached out to stop him. And then I'm just like trying to think, well, he didn't reach out with his left hand, right? He definitely did like the soccer mom stop to catch him. But then like he put his other hand out to brace himself from the attack. And that's what just sliced it to ribbons.
Ugh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it is such an important part of the whole thing. But then from there, because Rex Merrick was, I think, the coach at Temple, we see so little Robert Duvall in this movie, and that's such a shame.
No, I know. I really, really enjoy his character, and I really enjoy Duvall playing it, and the relationship between the two of them is so fucking, thick and poignant for, the 10 minutes he's in this movie, right? Like, it is so good. I am happy that it never goes to, it never wears out its welcome, right? Like, we are feeling that warm and fuzzy and that understanding, which is clearly important between the relationships with Kat and Vin later on, right?
Yeah.
Where, if it wasn't for knowing the ways that he was with their dad, these relationships would not quite work for me. There's some weird stuff with Kat where you wonder if she's supposed to be like a love interest or something. Again, I think that's a relic of maybe an old Sandler version of the script that got cleaned up. And then the stuff with Vin, he's just outright evil sometimes. But it all makes sense within the context of the relationship that Stan then has with their dad. And so there's too much of a good thing, right? Like, I'm glad there's not. I'm glad there's not too much of a good thing.
Right. Because if it had worn out, it's welcome. But I would also say, if you want to give me a prequel to this movie where it is Stan up to that accident, I mean, it's basically just Remember the Titans with basketball, I think. Yeah. that's what it would be. That's how I would pitch it. It's going to be Remember the Titans with basketball, because also Stan learning to like Leon in that sort of Julius Bertier story. Not that I think, I don't know. It's just like,
you're talking about Hoosiers, Devin. Let's move on.
I'm not talking about Hoosiers. It's more Coach Carter, if anything. Hoosiers, they're all white. They're all white in Hoosiers.
That's because it's Indiana.
Yeah, that's very true. But yeah, it's one of those situations where and Robert Duvall, he's there, it's enough of it, and it's enough to let you know that Vin hates him because he is jealous of the affection his father gives him, and Kat loves him in whatever way she loves him, whatever draft of the script, they are together in some way, shape, or form, because she sees so much of her father in him.
Exactly, yeah. Kat loves him because her father loved him, and she sees the same thing in him that her father. And in fact, Vin sees the same thing in him that his father did. He just, it's what he hates in him. It's beautiful. It really is. Yeah. Like it is this beautiful kind of like realization. And again, super tropey and super like low level, like screenwriting, but go watch A Star Is Born and tell me again, the third time you've seen that movie. But like,
I noticed it the first time,
but like this, no, I mean that movie's been made three times,
four times,
but
that was the fourth.
But this idea being that like, this piece of himself that he sees as a flaw and then hates about him and these two see in him and love, like that is the whole movie, right? It is this piece of him that he just kind of, he can't get rid of. He and at no point in this movie does Stan defy that piece of himself. It's another reason why this movie is so easy to rewatch, is there's never a moment where anybody acts out of character, even understandably so. Like every time somebody makes a move, even Vin in this movie as the villain of this piece, like every time they make a move, you completely understand the motivations and the complexities behind why they're doing it. Even if you don't agree with it, even if you don't love it, even if it makes you kind of like clutch your pearls, you still know where it's coming from. It's so well formed in that way.
Yeah, I agree. So what's your new, right? Because we've been talking off of Queen Latifah for a good 15 minutes. I'm proud of us.
So I, there's a couple of different things that I would address for new, but I think the big one that I'll focus on is Old Man Sand. Like this is really kind of the first picture where we've gotten to see him be older. The only thing that comes close is That's My Boy, in which he does play the dad figure. But notoriously, the story of that movie is that he has that kid when he's 13, right? Am I getting that age right?
Yep, that's exactly right.
So that idea being that he's not old is kind of the joke, is that he's only 13 years. He could just be an older brother to this character, which is the bit of the movie, right? So with that kind of out of the way, this is the first time where we really see Sandler, or at least in the cinematic universe that we've watched so far, really embrace his age, his aging in the world. You know, that may change when we look at some things like, I mean, you know, Grown Ups kind of plays with it a little bit. Even Hotel Transylvania kind of plays with it a little bit. But that idea that he is getting older and he's going to be in this position where now having a kid going off to college isn't weird, right? Like that is clearly where he's at in his life. And it's beautiful, right? Like even Uncut Gems, like as an older character, he never truly acts like it. In fact, acts quite childish in that film.
Because he's raging against his age. That's an interesting point.
Whereas this one, he doesn't seem to be denying it. He seems to be embracing it really, really beautifully.
Yeah, there's that beautiful line where he's like, 50-year-olds don't have dreams. We have nightmares and eczema. And that's just really like, oh, we have opened up the doorway into the next stage of Adam Sandler films.
I am so excited for Grandpa Sand. Because once we even get to him doing his, like, oh, I want to see him do, like, his Billy Madison when he's, like, 60. Like, I want to see what that movie is.
I want to see That's My Grand Boy. I'm excited for that film. And also, I mean, it's interesting when you bring up Old Man Sands and this being that first example, at least in the films that we've explored for the universe, because that's such the issue I had connecting with Hubie Halloween, is the fact that he acts like he's just sort of like a wacky 30-year-old, but it is very important that he is almost 50 years old in that movie.
Yeah, almost. It's like, it's important to you, the audience, but then nobody in the movie seems to ever acknowledge it. And it can be kind of off-putting, right?
It's super off-putting to me. I have the creeping horrors right now thinking of just like, it's such elder abuse and the whole town like writes it off as okay. Because they're all in on the joke, and so it is really interesting to see like a movie
rest in peace,
like
Ray
that.
Liotta. Sorry, but we talked about Hubie Halloween too much in this episode to not say rest in peace, Ray Liotta.
Yes, yeah, rest in peace, Ray. You were good in that film. It's a shame that you're not going to be in Hubie Halloween too, but I bet your character is going to have something to do with the plot still. oh my God! Imagine if Hubie is accused of murdering him. I'm there.
I'd like to think Liotta would go for it. Considering his role in B-movie, I think he'd be all about Adam Sandler using his passing as a plot point in Hubie Halloween 2.
Right. And especially, it'd be great. And you make it like a murder mystery crossover, too.
Oh, man!
And it all works.
And then the universe begins. It'll be the civil war of this universe.
Love it. Absolutely love it. And Eric
Which
Gordon...
Which one of Sandler's grows really big?
I don't know. I was trying to think of one where he puts on a lot of weight. It'd be Andy Samberg would be the one who gets really big. All right.
The famous Adam Sandler character, Andy Samberg. Yeah. Oh,
well,
man.
who knows?
We got
Okay. So what's your old? What's your old? Because I'm pretty sure that if by letting you go first, mine are safe.
Okay. Oh my God, I've got to go through my notes here. So my old is basketball. It's a cop out, it's like the most obvious one to kind of turn to here. It's the one that we have come to time and time again with Sandler. So and I just want to reiterate that, because I think there's so much going on in this movie that is not basketball that to anybody that hasn't seen it, it'd be a disservice, because like this movie is so basketball, and just the ways in which this movie captures not just like the game, but the life, because his traveling, it was like really wild, because this movie had me, again, another journey I went on was this whole like fucking thing of him traveling as a scout and kind of the nightmarish life that is of him constantly being around, not being around for what did he say? Nine birthdays.
He
for
has
his kid.
Missed 9 birthdays straight for his
right.
daughter.
And that's just horrifying. Right. So there's this whole aspect to it. And then he kind of has to do the same thing to Bo and bring him out of his life, because that's also what the ballers do, right? Yeah. And like there's just this whole aspect to it of like really kind of highlighting how much these guys really do give up. You know, it's not it's used in this movie as a justification for like the ways in which they are treated as rock stars, because they do all this, all the sacrifices that they make in their personal life justify the $900,000 paycheck that they're destined to get, right? Bullshit. No amount of money in the world should take a man away from his family for 9 birthdays, you know what I mean? Like that's just plain and simple. Like nobody should have to give up that much of their life for their job, no matter how much they love it. But that's not how we view sports, right? That's not how we view sports films, like, right? Guys giving up, like running away from their wedding day in order to be at the big game is like fucking just par for the course, to keep up with the sports metaphors.
And metaphors that would be old Sandler. I appreciate it. Yeah. On the topic of old being basketball, when we first see Bo Cruz and he is wearing work boots to play basketball, if your mind doesn't like Ratatouille flash to Davy Stone
yeah.
wearing his work boots and playing basketball, then you've never seen 8 Crazy Nights. That's all I have to say.
Well, and again, that kind of speaks to something where I feel like at some point Sandler had his hands on the script before or after, right? Well, because you're right. It totally goes to that. And the ways that supposedly represents somebody that is in it for the love of the game, the idea that he's willing to play it even in steel-toed boots, he'd play ball, means that he must have some love for this game.
That is one of my favorite moments. Not so much the innuendo, though I do love good innuendo in an Adam Sandler film, almost to the point that my old was food innuendo guy, but there are just better ones, where he goes, are the construction boots real, or is that just part of the hustle? And it's just like, yeah, he understands also that this guy is as good as he has at basketball, and what he is currently using it for is what Woody Harrelson was using it for in White Men Can't Jump,
right? Yeah. I mean, the whole bit about like you and me, like money on the table, you won't get 3 shots off the rim. Like it is a beautiful hustle, right? And what's beautiful about it is that in a lot of ways, it's not a mean one. Like that guy has all the opportunities in the world to hit the rim. He doesn't even have to get it in. He just has to hit the rim to win that bet. And this guy is just so good that he can't, and he knows that. So that's what the beauty is and the difference is between the hustle and the con, right? And I mean, this goes all the way back to Tom Cruise and playing pool, right? Like that idea being that, like, was it Tom Cruise in that movie with Paul Newman?
In Color of Money? I was actually just thinking of Color of Money earlier today. Yeah.
But it's that idea that, like, I just wanted to make sure I actually pulled that out of my ass. But it's that idea that, like, to be a hustler, you got to be good. To be a con man, you got to make everybody think you're good. But to be a hustler, you do need to be good. And that's, like, key to the whole concept.
You also need to be patient. That's the other big thing.
You got to work. Yeah, you got to be patient, you got to work, and you got to be good.
Because if you con them right out the gate, then it's dead to you. But if you work up to it, that's the way that Bo Cruz is able to get that guy to put 20 on the table for if you hit the rim 3 times, then this money is yours. But I'm going to stop you every time. It is just gorgeous. But yeah, those work boots, those brought me back to a certain place in time in the Adam Sandler cinematic
universe. That was a good pull. That was a very good pull, man.
But my actual old, I mean, it's the fact that his name is Stan. It's a reference to his dad, so Stan and Judy's kid right there. The fact that Dirk Nowitzki, the schnitzel, calls him Stan the Man at one point, which there's the song Stan the Man from Shh, Don't Tell, his 2004 album release, which I'm finding has a lot of references in his later movies. And that's interesting. Like, the Pib voice is the voice of the sock puppet, and that's my boy. I've already talked about it. And then the other old that I have is opposed to just the name Stan and it being so evocative of everything Adam Sandler is there's that moment where he feeds the goat fast food. And all I can think of is the goat sketch off of What the Hell Happened to Me. It's just like, and what I really like about that is that it's these clear moments of Adam Sandler, but not overpowering moments of Adam Sandler.
Just a dash.
Like, it's just enough to remind you that, like, this is a thing that's happened in his life before.
Yeah, I mean, it really makes you focus on the fact that he did not bring in all of his friends. He's not on the set with a bunch of dudes that he can fuck around with and get kind of lost in the bit. Like, he purposely surrounds himself with a lot of really talented, focused individuals and is able to pump out a really amazing focused film. Like, he knows what he's doing, and to that point, all of these movies where he wasn't doing it was a choice. At this point, you watch this movie and you understand everything that he's done that I didn't love, he did it for himself, he didn't do it for me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Rob Schneider wasn't the coach of the Spanish national team, that's how I knew.
Putting on a really racist caricature. Yeah.
Hey buddy, where is he? My donkey wants to meet him.
Yeah, let's bring it to him.
I brought in Ridiculous 6, too. I thought it would cover my ass for the terrible Rob Schneider impression I just did. All right. Going into Borrowed, I feel like this is going to be just rapid fire things that it's borrowed from.
Yeah. So the big thing I want to talk about is Sandler. Sorry if I'm like usurping this here for a second, but it clearly Sandler has learned a thing or two from the more dramatic directors he's worked with. We've talked a couple of times about the Safdies and all that, and about how this movie really evokes a lot of what he learned while he was working on Uncut Gems.
All right, I'm following so far.
But this idea that, like, there's also a little bit going on here with, like, the Noah Baumbach stuff that he's kind of been in terms of, like, the character building and the real moments and, like, relationships that he's willing to put on screen and things like that. Like, cause say what you will about Uncut Gems, there's a lot of people in that movie that didn't feel like real people, right?
Crazy because so many of them were based on real people, just real people playing themselves. My old was almost the fact that he just has people from the industry playing these fictionalized versions of themselves,
right?
Because they understand them. They know these people. Yeah. But yeah.
But a lot of the character stuff also comes from when he was with Noah Baumbach. And then some of the weirder filming stuff that you see that they attempt in this movie. Because as I mentioned, the guy that filmed this is really the first big motion picture he's done. So you have to imagine that the guy that's been there that's made 30 movies versus the guy where this is his first kind of big movie, right? It has to at least be consulting, asking him, like, what do you think? Like, is this what we're looking for? That kind of conversation, right? And there's definitely a ton of moments in this movie where I was thinking of Paul Thomas Anderson and Punch Drunk Love, right?
Cool. I dig that. My favorite thing is, let's make one of our characters a prospective film school student so that we can just fuck around with cinematography in cool experimental ways.
The one
that I think of is when it cuts to Bo sitting on the bleachers and literally all you see is the top of his head, and then the way that it, like, naturally brings him into focus, but even then he's not framed up as they're having this, like, discussion about him, and it's just like, that was so cool. And if you didn't have a character who is supposed to be in universe filming right now and someone who, like, wants to go to film school, I would be so taken out of it. But you've built up this beautiful excuse to do whatever you want with the camera.
Yeah, it's a wonderful, like, trope, is that in-universe excuse for weird camera angles and stuff is always good. The movie, it's an animated one, but it's the one that I think of when you mention this is Mitchell's versus the Machines is her whole thing, is she wants to go to film school, and so a lot of the stuff that you see in the movie is actually, like, her, like, imagining if she was filming it, what angles she would take and what effects she would use and stuff like that. But then, layered on top of that, she is very much kind of the DIY film school, so in that is also layered in, like, everything's made out of, like, cardboard and straw and stuff like that, and you're just like, yeah, like this would totally be the way that she would film this, you know. And it's a great, as you mentioned, in-universe excuse for just some really good style to be in your thing, in your movie.
Yeah, and again, Mitchells and the Machines was another short list for borrowed stuff, especially since they're both Netflix.
Yeah.
So you have that sort of, it like weirdly touches both films, right?
Yep.
And you're like, oh, the same thread was used in both of these garments.
Yeah, no, there's some real like there's some real invoking other movies throughout this and stuff, as there's been in a lot of Sandler stuff, because he's a dude that likes movies. We know that.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, it's you could literally just throw a rock, or you could just say any sports film and get points. But the big ones for me, the ones that it really evoked, this feels like the NBA answer to something like Draft Day, in terms of exploring maybe an oft-reported on, maybe misunderstood aspect of this sport. Like, I don't know if a lot of people knows what an open run is. In
Right.
terms of like, we're just going to have a bunch of prospective players come and show off for people. The combine, like the draft combine, I know what it is, and I want to imagine that most people do, but there have to be people who have no idea what that is. That
Yeah,
like
and I mean, and these ideas of these like backroom games and stuff like that, that these are things that happen. And then the idea that scouts like finding somebody like on a street court, like it's not out of the realm of possibility and part of everybody's kind of story in some ways, are these weird little intricacies. And we all kind of know it, you know. Again, you mentioned earlier like hoop dreams and stuff like that, because of these kinds of movies. But other than that, like this is a world that is so foreign to people.
Yeah, so that whole thing. But then the first thing I thought during the whole scouting aspect of it was The Air Up There, the Kevin Bacon movie from like '93. That
Nice.
if you know what I'm talking about, congratulations, you've seen a pretty cool movie that I saw in theaters at like four times, I think.
Wild.
Yeah, and just in terms of the scout who is just tired of getting jerked around as he travels to try to find the next big thing, and then just that excitement when he does find it, but then having to deal with all of the problems. And then the other one, and you know, call it May runoff or hangover, is The Scout with Albert Brooks and Brendan
Albert Brooks and
Fraser.
Brendan Fraser. Yeah, the one for me was Bull Durham, but yeah, the Scout was definitely the joke I was going to make because you just kept saying it.
yeah, because it right down to the fact that I was surprised that Bo wasn't just staying at their house. Like it, the way that Albert Brooks has Brendan Fraser just staying at his apartment because the team's not supporting him. Albert Brooks is supporting him in this journey to try to make him the next big thing. But a really interesting thing, and what it highlights is something that we have talked about with this, is how much of the NBA is appearances,
Yes.
and the fact that like if at any moment, what's his name? Stan had told Bo, we gotta have you stay at my house. Bo would have known that something was up. Like, Stan had to make him believe that the Sixers had him there. And actually, that's like the moment. The fact that this whole movie, Stan is lying to people and shouldering all of the responsibilities of this gamble that he is taking on Bo, that he calls a sure thing, but there's no such thing as a real sure thing, Sijin. Like, that's just what gambling addicts tell themselves. It was so the other side of the coin of a character like Howard Ratner that I'm like, if push came to shove, I could argue for why this is in the villain camp. Because his choices, they're not just choices that are destructive to him. I mean, it could be destructive to Bo, because Bo quits his job for this to
Yeah.
basically just follow the whims of Stan Sugarman. It could be destructive to his family in terms of the fact that he quits his job to get dedicate to this kid. And like, eventually the money's gonna stop. Like, 6 weeks after you lose your job, you still have savings. But once you get into that second month, like, it might be difficult for them to survive anymore. And it's just
No,
really
yeah, it's wild because the ways that this character is so much more sympathetic
Yeah.
than Bird was, right? Yeah.
Right. And it's and even that moment where he is caught and they have that whole sequence that, like you said, in lesser in a lesser script, probably would have become the rest of the movie, where Bo has his hands on him. And he's like, you fucking lied to me. Like, this is my life. You gambled with my life. And then the cops are just mysteriously there. Like, that I didn't love that part.
No.
But it is, and it's just one of those examples where, like, that could have been enough to have this guy have his visa revoked. And if that happens, then they're all fucked. Then there's right. no future for any of them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, man. It's, man. So we got one last one we got to do.
We got Blue. I'm going to let you go first.
I mean, honestly, like, the bluest thing in this movie is some of the ways in which Stan kind of struggles to interact with Bo and his family. Like, there's really not much more that I would point to, because otherwise this is a pretty beautifully diverse film. And I think even in those moments when Stan has these weird interactions with Bo and, like, he tries to speak Spanish and all that, like, it comes from a place of sincerity and trying to be with Bo. Like, I don't think he ever uses it at any point to be insulting or mean to him, right? But, you know, like, he makes the jokes about
his mom
and stuff
like that. Well, there is
that
scene where he specifically learned Spanish to insult him. But I understand what you're saying.
But even in that, right, it is supposed to be this idea of him getting closer to him, right? So so there's definitely some stuff in this movie about the idea of Stan. And as I talked about earlier, it all kind of gets fed by the larger concept of this being a white savior film. At its heart, that's what it is. And, like, we've seen those movies before where the white guy comes in and somehow saves the foreign dude or foreign people of some type that are otherness to them. And it's because of their ability as a white man to do it. It can get gross if you really start digging down into it. But what this movie does is this movie tries to push it back against it where it can. And, like, I'll always applaud progress, even if it's baby steps.
Right. I mean, one of the only known things about this film is that originally it was going to be a ball player from China, not someone from Spain. And it was Netflix who said, yeah, we don't do business in China, so you need to change that.
I mean, considering everything that has gone on and the ways in which, you know, you unpack that one for days, right?
Yeah, exactly. But talking specifically about white savior, because what this film eventually becomes weirdly packaged as is more of an American savior type film, which is like a whole new, like, slice of genre to try to dissect, is that, like, this American comes in and with what America can offer to the world, Team America, fuck yeah,
If the NBA is not emblematic of anything, it's emblematic of America, like, over gluttonous
excess, baby. Yeah, it's oof. Yeah, so that's a really interesting thing, as you say, white savior, because it's like, well, yeah, but he's saving another white person. So it's like, all right, cool. So you want to be an asshole about it? Let's call it an American savior film, in the terms of, like, America can go into any foreign situation, and what we're offering is going to save them. From the situation they're in.
From the poor, you know, ghetto that they live in, or whatever nonsense you want to spout, yeah.
Do you know how many guns he had when he was in Spain? Zero. Now he owns 27.
Oh, damn. Oh, man. But, yeah, so what did you get for Blue, Dev?
So for Blue is Rex's suit.
Yes!
That powder blue suit, and it is so emblematic. It is not just the fact that when we see Robert Duvall, he is wearing that blue suit. And I have to tell you, before I knew that Kat was his daughter, I thought he was kind of sexually assaulting the only woman in the room. And I'm like, oh, God, no, Robert Duvall, please don't be a Me Too guy. Please don't have that be the movie. And then, no, it's his daughter. So, like, all that stuff becomes affection for your child.
This sexual assault is fine.
This sexual assault is fine. No. It's only sexual assault if it's a stranger or an employee.
Consensual.
Yeah. When it's a father, like, kissing his daughter on the forehead or the hands, it's like, oh, that's nice. That's a nice moment.
Yeah, as long as it's consensual.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, true. Good point. Yeah. Consent is important. But the moment that just speaks volumes is when he goes to the funeral reception, the wake, whatever you want to call it, because every, you know, different religion or culture has a different term for what that is. The memorial service. And he goes in the same exact style of suit.
Yeah.
It is like that happened. And, like,
Is Dr. J that calls him out on it? Somebody does. Somebody says that's
Leon
a nice
Rich
move on
says
the suit.
Nice job with this. And that's like the moment that establishes his friendship with that character is the fact that like this is a guy who knows Stan. And we don't really see a lot of that because Stan is so on the road. So this like stranger guy at this memorial service who's in the film for maybe 4 or 5 scenes, played magnificently by Kenny Smith. Kenny Smith, the ball player, not Kenny Smith, the actor, just bringing so much to the character of Leon Rich. Like being like, it was a nice touch with the suit. But then also it's like, yeah, but it's a huge shot over the bow in terms of the fact that like, I showed up to this funeral in this suit honoring him that is blue. And then you just, there's that beautiful moment where Ben Foster like kind of glares at him in this like, fuck you moment. It's
we
great.
Haven't talked enough about Ben Foster.
We haven't talked enough about Ben Foster.
Phenomenal role to play the villain in this movie. The antagonist, I guess we should say.
Ever since 3:10 to Yuma, you see that guy, you're like, I do not trust you.
Yeah, you know the one for me, like 3:10 to Yuma, definitely. But soon after that, he did 40 Days of Night with Josh Hartnett there, the really weird Steve Niles adaptation, and he plays the like old prospector that first gets arrested. It's phenomenally creepy as like this like gibberish talking eventual like vampire man. Ben Foster is like a villainous dude. Also, The Mechanic, for anybody that wants to check out a really wild ride of a movie.
Also, I'm going to recommend, because one of the things that happened in the house was, man, I wish Justin Timberlake was playing this role. And I'm like, oh, he's actually Justin Timberlake's brother in Alpha Dog.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
If you want another like great Ben Foster role, like do not ever wish for somebody besides Ben Foster, because you got Ben Foster in your movie. Shit's about to go down.
Yes, yeah, but he just brings a lot to like the kind of the moment that you're talking about, right? Like, like the really just quiet resentment that he has for Stan throughout this whole movie, and it's always on display, but it's never spoken. It's beautiful.
Yeah, I mean the moment that for me is that remark where he's like, "Sorry, Stan, you're gonna have to pick up the tab on this kid. The Sixers don't want him." And he's just like, I never fucking asked you to do that. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Oh, and then that's the one that's like quickly followed by, I guess you'll have to miss another of your daughter's birthdays, right?
Right.
Like,
Don't worry. The organization will send her something nice.
Oh, man. Yeah.
He's just like, no wonder Stan quits his job in that moment.
He's perfectly gross.
It is. Yeah. So, yeah. But yeah, Rex's suit and it's this moment that like it showed up on screen on Robert Duvall. And I'm like, well, that's going to be my blue. And then
I got to applaud you, man, because you have pulled out a goddamn like meaningful, important blue in this
fuck
movie.
You. No. They're always meaningful to me.
No. They're always meaningful to me. No, but like, well, it's his blue Speedo when he jumps in the pool. Like, no, this was an important one.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. When it came back later, I'm like, oh, man, I chose wisely. I just thought I was choosing because, you know, I do the two viewings of the film, right? I do the for fun viewing and then the academic viewing is what I joke is when I have a notebook in front of me. So usually during the fun viewing, I try to knock off the new old borrowed blue so it's not in the back of my mind the whole time.
Right.
So, like, that's the third seed where you see Robert Duvall in that blue suit. And I'm like, there's my blue. I'm done. I've written them all off now. I get it now. I have my new, my old. My new is Queen Latifah. My old is the GOAT. My Bard is the heir up there. And my blue is Robert Duvall. I can now just sit and enjoy this film. Nice. And then for that blue suit to actually be like heavily plot significant, I'm like, man, I lucked out that I can just shut the book on that. All right. So what I'd like to talk about in the discussion, right, is the fact that we joked in the Uncut Gems episode, which again, right, just because it's sort of the joke of the episode, if you haven't listened, please go listen to the Uncut Gems episode. I think you'll understand this one so much more. We joked that everything in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe had been leading up to that Uncut Gems moment. And then weirdly, with The Hustle, sort of completely unintentionally, every film that we looked at as part of season 3, the Sandler villains, kind of felt like it was leading up to The Hustle. Am I, like, completely off base with that read on this film? Like, it's...
You lucked out with this one in a lot of ways. No, you're not wrong. I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like, it's Infinity War and Endgame, right? Like,
yeah.
There is something about landing on these two films. And again, not that we planned it that way. I'm never going to act like that.
How could we have? We knew nothing about this film except basketball.
Right. So there's this idea that... that the way these two movies talk to each other and the ways in which they're informed by everything that came before it, for sure, right? And that's always been the whole point of the project, right? Is kind of figuring out how all of these movies inform one another, not just by character, right? Because that's always kind of been the joke that we've hung our hat in as well. If this character shows up, then clearly it's in the same universe. But also, like, we've dove into the fact that, like, also there just has to be, like, an oomph. There has to be an attitude. There has to be something there. Now, whether or not the attitude is present in Uncut Gems and this to put it in the universe, go listen to the Uncut Gems episode and you might get a spoiler on that. But like that idea being that they at least feel like they go together. And yes, all of the movies leading up to it from this season have felt like it's definitely been informing this movie for good or for ill.
Well, I think what's really interesting about that, especially in terms of you saying this is Adam Sandler, as opposed to doing a That's My Boy, where, like, if this is what you think my movies are, I'm just going to deliver you the absolute bottom of the fucking barrel with this film. And then with The Hustle, it feels like, oh, you don't think I can do this on my own? That I can produce, like, a engaging, like, well-developed, dramatic film? I always need to be in someone else's film to do that. And then this movie comes along. It would make sense that those villainous films, those films that people sort of question or like have that like bad aura around the memory in, would be the parts of his career that he would try to write.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I mean, like specifically, like it started when we met Bo's family and like just the whole, the cultural difference between them and the fact that he can't speak the language. And I'm just like, man, this is so Spanglish, but like good. Like this whole like inability to communicate with each other and then trying to find that common ground.
Yeah.
Like feels so much realer and so much like better informed than it did in 2004 in a film like Spanglish.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, better informed for real. And remember, the big thing that we talked about with Spanglish is, again, we like don't levy that all on Sandler, because a lot of that was coming from James L. Brooks, right? Like,
right.
Like that whole thing. But yes, I mean, yes, it is better handled. I would hope so 10 years later, right?
Exactly, but that's not always the case,
that's not
right?
Always the case. No,
and
no,
but
that's
and I think
case.
That one of the reasons why it's better handled is because he was involved in something like that.
Yeah.
Like, where he got to see an actor who did not speak any English when she was hired for that film and how she was treated.
Right.
Like, everything you do sort of informs... It's not about this shot, it's about the next shot, right? Another big theme of The Hustle. And so, like, of course, I'm going to be a little bit, you know, looking back. Like, he's not... He goes all over the world in that opening montage and interacts with so many different types of people. And rather than go for any of the like really easy ethnic jokes like he would have done in Ridiculous Six, all of the jokes are like that. The whole joke with the big Serbian, which again, that's not great that they didn't give that guy a name.
I think weirdly he does get a name in the credits. Actually.
In the credits, he's credited as the big Serbian. That's how he's credited. That's why I'm referring to him as that.
Hold on one second. Let me pull it up, because he does get a weird name in the at least the, I will say, IMDb credits.
Okay,
so he is Big Serbian Dmitri Jovanovic.
Yeah, but Dmitri Jovanovic is playing that role.
No, Boban Marjanovic is playing
Dmitri Jovanovic. Whoa, because I'm an asshole.
Yes. Big Serbian - Dmitri Jovanovic is the way he is credited.
That's nuts, because he is credited as just the Big Serbian in that whole montage of all these actual guys and who they played.
Yeah.
That's interesting that he has a name. So Dmitri, I will refer to him by his actual name, because I little shudder. Like, the whole joke there is just the fact that there's no way this guy is 22.
Yes, right.
Like, that's the whole joke. It's like, this is your son? How old is your son? He's 10. and just, yeah, I'm gonna pack up and go. Like, it would be so easy, and we've seen it before, just going for that low-hanging ethnic joke. And really, the big joke in that whole thing is the American who's just eating freaking American fast food while he's going to all of these locations.
Yeah. He keeps just ordering just fucking Pizza Hut and Burger King.
Pizza Hut, Burger King, Wendy's, KFC, McDonald's. They all get a little bit of product placement. If Subway weren't such a terrible company, or if he had gone to, I believe it's Korea that has the Subway soap operas. Have you seen that stuff?
Oh,
that's Say Report territory, my friend. But yeah, that's a whole thing. The fact that Subway doesn't make an appearance in his fast food smorgasbord is crazy to me. But that's, like, the joke is more about this American in these locales. It is not about the indigenous people, for lack of a better term. And that is just, that works, like, in terms of something like Ridiculous 6, where it is just a race to the bottom for the easiest stereotypical joke for everybody.
Yeah.
And then funny people and the way that George Simmons exists in the world, like, that's so Stan when he's outside of the country. And then when he's with the woman he loves again, he lights up and he's a completely different person. But this time is not like an affair, right? And that's the thing. Like, you talk about prior drafts, maybe Kat Merrick was married, but then when Stan was alone with her, he lit up. And then he's like, no, that's just funny people. And it's a terrible aspect of that funny people character. Chuck and Larry, in terms of the stigma surrounding the choices in your life and how that goes. I don't know. It just, this felt so informed, like so weirdly informed by the last six films we watched. And maybe it was just Bader Meinhof of it all, but I honestly feel like these are some of those movies that he has considered, like, these are the ones that get shit. These are the ones that people levy criticism against. So I'm going to try to answer those deficiencies with this film where I'm proving myself to the world. I don't know.
Yeah, man. Beautifully said. No, this movie invokes a lot, right? Yeah. Both this season and beyond of what we've done in the series and other movies besides Sandler movies. That's why I started this whole thing by saying that this movie kind of elevates itself above even the purpose of this very show for me, in that it was just one of those movies that just changes your opinion on the day, on your life, on you know, it does what a good movie should do, and it affects you. And it affected me. And, like, that is not rare in these Sandler films, but not always the case.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Instant classic? Are you willing to say that at this point?
I mean, right now, with the subject to change, because sometimes context and minds change, but, like, it feels that way. It definitely feels like it's going to hit one of those marks for me where 10 years from now, I'm going to be talking about that great sports movie, Hustle.
Yeah, there's a reason why I compared it to Draft Day. Because Draft Day became one of those movies to me that I think of as a great sports film, and thought of it as soon as I left the theater that day, right? Everything that Seijin is describing in terms of his relationship with The Hustle, that's how I felt when I saw Draft Day. Because I was at my lowest when I saw that movie.
This entire episode, I have made sure to not call it The Hustle, and now you have done that for the fourth time.
No!
Yes! I was not going to point it out, but after three, and then you did it again.
I summoned Beetlejuice. I get it. I said it three times. Oh, screw me. Well, it's Hustle. The film is Hustle, and it's hard to call it just Hustle. You always want to put some. I'm also 100. This is the reveal of Old Man Dev, where I'm 100 years old and put the in front of everything. As I speak into the microphone at the desk using the garage band. All right. So I think it's time, Seijin. I think it's time to take out the scales of the ASCU, the Justice. See, it's a tick I have. I put the in front of everything, the Seijin.
I don't see any reason why this would fit into the universe. I think that there's a lot of love for this movie, and there's a lot that is informed by Sandler as a creative in this movie, for sure. But, like, it doesn't hit the marks that I think we have set up for what would fall into the universe. You know, and that being said, like, good. I'm glad that a movie this good can exist outside of this, like, realm of him needing to kind of go back to the well on a lot of things.
I agree. In fact, I was almost afraid that I blew up my feelings on that early on in this, where I'm like, we're going to talk about, even though we like a movie, that doesn't necessarily mean it's in the universe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or also, as I think you've seen, even when we don't like a movie, that doesn't mean that we're not going to admit that the stuff that's necessary for it. Because that was the last big hurdle I had to clear with this film, was the fact that so much of this movie was so good, and maybe because it was so good, that I'm like, is that what eliminates it from consideration for the universe for me? Or is it just the fact that it is so diametrically opposed to everything else that we have established up to this point that we'd be trying to fit, you know, a square block into a round hole?
Yeah. No go. Nope, no. That being said, I still very much enjoy this movie. I don't want that final judgment to come down as like our judgment on the film itself.
Yeah, and I'm glad that we get to answer that. 20 episodes in, it is an important distinction that just because we don't put it in the universe doesn't mean we don't like the movie. And yeah. I do. I really do like this movie. I am excited for more people to see it and to have more discussions with it. I am going to try to get a live tweet of this one. I think it'd be an interesting film to live tweet. I'm going to try to contact the Twitter Sandler Movie Club and see if they'd be interested in doing this one. So we'll see where it goes from there. But this is definitely one of those movies that sticks with me, and I hope that it goes on to do great things in a year where everything else is morbid.
Just to put us in a time and place, yeah.
Well, what are you going to do? Well, the time and the place is June 2022 when Hustle came to Netflix town.
Man.
All right, so is there anything else that you want to say about this movie, Siegen, before we send it off? Or
I mean, not enough credit to all of the people that show up in this movie that are you know, consider themselves actors and don't, that just wanted to be there for a good time but still put in the work. Like, the way that the world is built in this movie is beautiful and beautifully done by the filmmakers, but a lot of that is attributed to the ways in which the people in this movie fill out this world just wonderfully. And like, it really does bring an element of like kind of a warm, fuzzy realism to this movie.
Good. Yeah, I agree. The big problem when you fill your movie with a bunch of fun cameos is that it becomes nay impossible to pay proper credit to all of the people who show up in the movie.
Yeah.
Something like Uncut Gems is real easy to be like, it was cool to see The Weeknd. It was cool to see Cash Out. Kevin Garnett,
yeah.
big fan of you showing up and acting. I guess that's the last thing. It was really cool to go from a movie where Doc Rivers was the coach of the Celtics to a movie where Doc Rivers was the coach of the Philadelphia 76ers.
Up against the Celtics, right?
Yeah, up against the Celtics. Like these two movies really do feel like a weird companion piece. And I hope that even if you did listen to this one all the way through to the end, you didn't jump to Uncut Gems, you do go back and check out the Uncut Gems episode, because these are really two films that weirdly inform each other in some of the best ways possible.
Mm-hmm.
All right, excellent. So we already signed off season 3 at the end of the Uncut Gems episode, but just a reminder that starting in July, season 4 is season 4 The Fans. So we're going to be doing those movies that everybody has asked us to do.
But y'all won't shut up.
Yeah, seriously. And that is why we're kicking it off. We're coming out of the gate strong with Big Daddy.
Yes.
So July, look for the Big Daddy episode. I'm very excited to do that one. Though I think I'm excited for a different reason than Siegen. Siegen seems excited because we're watching the movie. I'm excited because when people say, have you done Big Daddy? I can say yes and send them a link. I no longer have to say no and then deal with, well, why haven't you? Do you think it's not in there? And it's like,
look,
no,
man,
no,
it's rare that I get to see Jon Stewart in a movie, okay? Give me a break.
It's rare that anyone gets to see Jon Stewart in a movie. I'm excited for Cole and Dylan Sprouse.
Yeah, man, so much to talk about.
Yeah,
but yeah,
it'll be exciting.
We ain't stopping anytime soon, folks.
Yeah, exactly. We're keeping up with the same schedule. But yeah, so it's Big Daddy next month. And if there's a movie that you want us to talk about get to us. Send us an email to AdamSandlerCinematicUniverse@gmail.com or get us on Twitter at the ASCU and let us know the movies that you want us to cover. And, you know, if there's enough outcry for one or you happen to hit one that like, oh, yeah, man, that is one that we've been meaning to do. Let us know. Also understand that Sijin and I do have some plans for how this show goes. So it might be
just like pull it out of our butts all the time.
Right. So you might suggest a movie that we would love to do for the fans, but we already have it earmarked for season 5, season 6 and beyond. Right. Because we do have access to the entire filmography at this point.
For now, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless he releases another movie. Right. Murder Mystery 2. I guess that's the last thing. Right. Sijin, how did you feel this worked? Did you feel good about like just diving into the new movie like within 36 hours of it releasing? Or do you think
I liked it as an experiment within the context of what we do here. But I mean, I think the larger point of what we do here kind of relies on the way the world has developed a feeling about it versus how we agree or disagree with that, right?
Right. And I guess the best part about that is maybe sometime down the line we'll get to rehustle and explore this film with some context after the fact, some hindsight, some 2024 hindsight.
The hustle? Is that what you wanted to say?
No, I I said rehustle. I was proud of myself. You son of a... Anywho, yeah. So that's it. So that's where we're at. Thank you very much for coming on this extra bonus journey with us. If you listen, let us know. We'd love to hear from you. If you like this, all like hyper-focused and everything, though admittedly, this bonus episode, we got a little punchy and we got a little ranty. We also do another podcast that drops weekly. That's called The Say Report. And that one, everything is on the table. And again, like promises, this next episode, I'm definitely talking about Wings, whether Sijin wants to or not.
Just a slight preview for you there. Yeah.
So that's it. But if you would like to get in touch with Sijin directly and share with him your other experiences with living in a hotbed of like a certain thing, like if you live in the I'm trying to think of the Park City of, I don't know, new ice cream flavors, and you want to share what that's like, you can find him on Twitter at Siege Versus the World.
And if you want to know where Devin got that fabulous Adam Sandler blanket, you can reach out to him at Devin D. Decker.
I get no commission on it, but oh my God, I want to add it to everybody's life. It has changed my life. I feel taller, more confident, funnier. It's been a great time. All right. Well, we will see you in season 4. And remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me. And we'll see you next time.